You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
A system that will grant legal status to temporary workers who are here in the country working, that will increase the number of men and women on the path to American citizenship.
That was President George W. Bush speaking before a group of Latino voters earlier this month in San Antonio, Texas. He was promoting immigration reforms that would grant undocumented workers guest worker status so they could legally work in the United States. However, last week, White House officials asked Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist not to offer a bill that would do just that. The bill, sponsored by Republican Senator Larry E. Craig of Idaho, would help 500,000 farm workers gain legal residency. The bill died when the Senate adjourned until fall. The bill had the support of 63 senators, including 27 Republicans and 12 committee chairmen. Craig vowed to introduce the bill next session, which will give the president the opportunity to repeat this statement he made in Texas.
This proposal reflects the interest and best values of America, and Congress should pass it into law.
On Tuesday, during the Democratic National Convention, the Campaign for America's Future hosted a panel of speakers, including Michael Moore and Howard Dean. Former Secretary of Labor under Bill Clinton, Robert Reich, standing at a height of 4 feet 10 inches, spoke about how President Bush's tax cut doesn't help America's workers in a lagging economy.
Now, every time you hear them say and use the word average, watch your wallets. The basketball player Shaquille O'Neal and I have an average height of 6'1". It's just like the Bush tax cuts. They said that the average tax cut is $1,000. But Dick Cheney got a tax cut of $300,000. Most Americans are getting under $100 tax cuts.
A strike by the Illinois Secretary of State employees has been authorized if negotiations fall through. The workers, represented by the Service Employees International Union, could walk off the job as soon as August 16th if their demands aren't met. Secretary of State Jesse White has offered an 8% increase over 4 years, but with union members' pension payments at 4% of their salaries, it would actually only amount to a 4% increase stretched out over 4 years.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Feel like you're working yourself to death? You just might be. New research from Finland finds that work-related stress can double a person's risk of heart attack. Researchers at the University of Helsinki found that otherwise healthy workers who reported persistent stress due to heavy work demands and low job security were just as likely to fall victim to heart attacks as heavy smokers who do not exercise.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You put in 30 years at the company. You got good pay, health care. Then they send you a job overseas. And under George Bush, the company actually gets a tax break for doing it. Now, Bush says we're in recovery. Then after a year, you finally land another job. And you wonder, is this what you worked your whole life for? We're not being led. We're being misled.
Despicable is not a word that major corporate executives are used to having hurled at them by high elected officials. But the honchos of Diebold Inc. recently got this very word right in their corporate face. The hurler was Kevin Shelley, California's Secretary of State, and he was referring to his experience with Diebold's electronic voting machines in California's March primary elections. Computer glitches plagued that election, jeopardizing its outcome. For example, thousands of San Diego voters were turned away from the polls because Diebold machines malfunctioned. A subsequent investigation by a state panel of experts on electronic voting found that this company, the second largest purveyor of touchscreen voting machines in the country, had violated state law by installing untested and uncertified software in its machines, then lied about it. Their performance, their behavior is despicable, Shelley bluntly said. He also put action behind his words, banning the use of more than 14,000 Diebold machines for this November's election, saying that the machines are not secure and reliable. He also recommended that criminal charges be filed for what he called fraudulent actions by Diebold. Shelley had earlier ruled that by 2006, touchscreen voting machines in California must produce a paper receipt so voters can verify the electoral choices they make on these corruptible computers. But after this year's unpleasantness with Diebold, Shelley says he's now exploring ways to speed up this requirement. This is Jim Hightower saying, meanwhile, in Maryland, a voters group has filed suit to block the use of all 16,000 of Diebold's virtual voting machines in their state unless a paper verification system is installed on each of them. It's all a part of the growing grassroots rebellion to prevent the electronic theft of our elections. To join the fight, go to www.verifiedvoting.org.
I'm sorry, there's nothing more we can do. No one wants to hear those devastating words from a doctor. But that's what millions of Americans suffering from diseases like Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and diabetes will be told. If you vote for Ralph Nader. Americans who voted for Nader put Bush in the White House in 2000. As president, George W. put the brakes on embryonic stem cell research, which could lead to revolutionary new treatments and cures. John Kerry vows to push this research forward. George W. Bush is still taking orders from the religious right. He wants to stifle stem cell research. This time, don't help him. Don't vote for Ralph. The Committee for the Advancement of Stem Cell Research approved this message. It was not approved by any candidate, nor any candidate's committee. Visit CASCR.org.
Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, happy Wednesday, friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here, broadcasting live coast to coast, border to border, streaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite, broadcasting all across the nation on terrestrial radio stations from California to North Carolina, and beaming around the internet on radiopower.org and cable radio network. President George W. Bush reports Capitol Hill Blue, the Washington, D.C. publication that you can find online, capitolhillblue.com. President George W. Bush is taking powerful antidepressant drugs to control his erratic behavior, depression, and paranoia, Capitol Hill Blue has learned. The prescription drugs administered by Colonel Richard J. Tubb, the White House physician, can impair the president's mental faculties and decrease both his physical capabilities and his ability to respond to a crisis, administration aides admit privately. It's a double-edged sword, says one aide. We can't have him flying off the handle at the slightest provocation, but we also need a president who is mentally alert. Apparently, this started July 8th when the president stormed off the stage after reporters asked him about his relationship with Ken Lay. He said, "Keep those something away from me." He screamed at an aide backstage, "If you can't, I'll find someone who can." Talking about, you know, keeping the reporters away from Bush. Capitol Hill Blue has done other stories. June 4th, they did one about his mood swings and obscene outbursts. Although GOP loyalists dismissed the reports as anti-Bush propaganda, the reports were later confirmed by prominent George Washington University psychiatrist Dr. Justin Frank in his book Bush on the Couch. Dr. Frank diagnosed the president as a paranoid megalomaniac and untreated alcoholic whose lifelong streak of sadism ranging from childhood pranks, using firecrackers to explode frogs, to insulting journalists, gloating over state executions, and pumping his hand gleefully over the bombing of Baghdad showcased Bush's instabilities. It's an article that raises a few concerns, I would say. It'll be interesting to see how that gets spun. It'll probably get lost in the fog of John Kerry wearing a clean suit into one of these NASA facilities that made him look like Woody Allen's sperm character. And you can bet that since the cons can't win on the issues, that they will be talking about that all day. Today, on this day in history, July 28, 1914, Austria-Hungary, which at that time was one nation, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, declared war on Serbia. Remember, Archduke Ferdinand was assassinated in Sarajevo? Thus began World War I. And I think the lesson of this. So the thing that's really interesting about the way that World War One started was that nobody thought it was a big deal. You know, the Archduke Ferdinand gets assassinated, and it's like, it made headlines, but everybody goes, so what? And then Hungary says, okay, we're going to have a war on Serbia. And it's like, But the problem was all these countries had these pacts, these treaties with other countries that said, well, if somebody declares war on you, then that's the same as declaring war on me. And so this country had to go to Russia had to go to the defense of Serbia, and Germany had to go to the defense of Hungary, and boom, you've got the whole of Europe in the middle of a war. You just never know how fast these things spiral out of control and what kind of danger they represent. The Democratic National Convention is rolling along. We've got some great clips from it. And, in fact, Ted Kennedy's presentation last night, which I thought had some really extraordinary moments. He blew a couple of lines, unfortunately, because they were really well-written lines, either he or his speechwriters or whoever. But he raised a couple of issues that really need to be put into context. And I went back to his brother, John Kennedy's speeches, including the speech that his brother John Kennedy gave about how America is perceived by the world as a shining city on the hill, the one that Ronald Reagan plagiarized. And I want to share that with you today. And we've got some clips from Teresa and Heinz Kerry, an overview, Obama, and lots of interesting stuff. At 12:30 Eastern time, at the bottom of this hour, in 18 minutes from now, we're going to have John Dean on, the former Watergate figure. He was the chief counsel. He had the job for Richard Nixon that Alberto Gonzalez has right now for George W. Bush. And he was the guy who told Nixon that the Watergate thing that was spiraling out of control, and Liddy and these guys doing all this nasty stuff right out of the White House, the plumbers unit trying to bug or steal documents from the Democratic National Committee's headquarters in the Watergate building. This was an attempt by the Nixon campaign to disrupt and gain intelligence on the Democratic campaign, and thus win the elections, spin the elections, throw the elections. John Dean is the guy who said there's a cancer on the presidency, and didn't go along with it. And Nixon canned him for it, and he's now a professor of law in California and doing amazing things. And he just wrote this book called Worse Than Watergate: The Secret Presidency of George W. Bush, which I'm sure you'll find interesting. And if you have questions for him, our number 1-866-889-8894, and John Dean will be on at the bottom of the hour. And in the next hour, we're going to have on for a little bit, the beginning of the hour, John Powers, the guy who wrote Sore Winners, which I think you'll find very interesting. So the war in Iraq. Here we have a million people who it looks like there's a very high probability, perhaps you could even say a virtual certainty, that these people are going to die in the south of Sudan. The Janjaweed, these Arabs from the north of Sudan, going on robbing, raping, pillaging expeditions, wiping out cities, driving these people into refugee camps to the south and into other countries. And now the rainy season is just a few weeks, a few months at the very most away. The rainy season comes in the summer, our summer, toward the end of our summer. And once that happens, we will not be able to get trucks with food in there, and these people will die of starvation. I'm telling you, I was in Uganda in 1980 and 1981 during the famine. In fact, we took over the Namalu prison farm in northern Uganda and turned it into a refugee center. And we had about 30,000-40,000 people there, mostly from the just average folks from the cities in the south, from Keramoja and Mbale and Soroko. But many of them also tribal people from the north. My job every morning was to go, one of many jobs, was to go through, and we had people segregated into different rooms depending on what they were dying of. I mean, they were all dying of hunger, basically, because the Red Cross had pulled out. We were waiting to get the food in. The Red Cross had pulled out because their people had been were being shot at. And so we had, you know, one big room that was the people who had tuberculosis, and one actually the biggest was the kids who had kwashiorkor, which is where the belly gets really, it's protein deficiency disease. It's the last stages of malnutrition. And my job was to go through in the morning and take out the people who had died during the evening, and then me and this old Ethiopian priest, this old shriveled up little guy, would take this tractor, this bulldozer, this little bulldozer, and bury them. And it was a very difficult experience. And this is going to happen again on a much larger scale than what I saw in the Sudan. And here comes this report today that is being, it's being published today in England. Probably has been by now because it's the middle of the afternoon, late afternoon now in the UK. By a group called the Foreign Policy Center, which is a think tank that Tony Blair is a patron of. Our, you know, our ally, Tony Blair, he's one of the guys who helped fund this thing, make it happen. And they are saying, in fact, the report's author, Dr. Greg Austin, says, the lessons of the Rwandan genocide have not been learned. British and military and American military action in Iraq has prevented these two countries from considering putting boots on the ground in Sudan. So the bottom line, this article in The Independent today by Ben Russell, Britain and America's preoccupation with Iraq has blocked international efforts to end genocide in the war-torn Darfur region of Sudan, according to a highly critical report published by a think tank close to Tony Blair. The unintended consequences of this casual decision, a seemingly casual decision to go to war. I say seemingly casual decision because we know that in March and April of 2001, before 9/11, Dick Cheney in his Energy Task Force meeting with Ken Lay and others from the oil industry was dividing up the oil riches of Iraq, was dividing up the oil fields of Iraq and deciding which oil companies they would sell it to. And this this is not surmise. I mean, this actually has come out of a lawsuit by Judicial Watch against Dick Cheney, the lawsuit that he took to the Supreme Court 2 months ago to keep us from knowing about it. And the Supreme Court said, no, sorry, Mr. Cheney, you have to tell the American people about this, but you can wait until after the election. So, you know, that plus right after 9/11, 2 days after 9/11, according to multiple sources, including people within the administration. You had, well, I mean, look at the news reports. You had Dick Cheney going on TV saying, we think that Saddam Hussein has something to do with this. You had Don Rumsfeld talking about Saddam Hussein. Within 2 days, you had George Bush talking about Saddam Hussein within the White House, saying, oh, here's an opportunity. We can go after Saddam Hussein. And, you know, just to finish off his daddy's business. I mean, is that, you know, what's going on here? CNN out, the media alert for the day. This is from MediaMatters.org. CNN's Miles O'Brien. It's just incredible how these guys who portray themselves as reporters. I'm a reporter, yeah. Put in these editorial comments. I mean, you've got the situation where, you know, Limbaugh has been comparing Howard Dean to Saddam Hussein. And Ann Coulter writing that you know, she was looking forward to his speech because rumor has it he'll end with a squeal so high-pitched only dogs will be able to hear it. Yeah. I mean, we know that, you know, Dean's famous scream, he was in a room that was so loud he could hardly hear himself. The mic, of course, didn't pick up the room noise because when you've got a loud room, you use a mic that the gain is cranked way down and you have to shout into the microphone. And just the clean audio of you comes through instead of all the screaming in the room. And, you know, he screamed, hey, what the heck, you know? Yeah. He was enthusiastic. But here, you know, what they've been trying to do now is characterize this guy who is a major truth teller in the Democratic Party and continues to be as some kind of nut, right? Well, that's, I mean, you know, on the Reich for, you know, right-wing commentators, truth tellers in America, I guess, are nuts. Because the truth isn't how it works. So CNN's Miles O'Brien last night on CNN says, Howard Dean, want to see if he, you know, melts down or something. And, yeah. So the, you know, the spin goes on even on CNN. 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Stick around.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is a small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates lock out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
I'm sorry. There's nothing more we can do. No one wants to hear those devastating words from a doctor. But that's what millions of Americans suffering from diseases like Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and diabetes will be told if you vote for Ralph Nader. Americans who voted for Nader put Bush in the White House in 2000. As president, George W. put the brakes on embryonic stem cell research, which could lead to revolutionary new treatments and cures. John Kerry vows to push this research forward. George W. Bush is still taking orders from the religious right. He wants to stifle stem cell research. This time, don't help him. Don't vote for Ralph. The Committee for the Advancement of Stem Cell Research approved this message. It was not approved by any candidate, nor any candidate's committee. Visit CASCR.org.
At last, there's a positive focus on a condition that affects millions. Read The Edison Gene, ADHD and the Gift of the Hunter Child by Tom Hartman, best-selling author of Attention Deficit Disorder, A Different Perception. John Rady, author of User's Guide to the Brain, says this about the Edison Gene.
Once again, with tireless scholarship and a bit of poetry, Tom Hartman helps take us to the edge of knowing ourselves, our brains, and our world.
The Edison Gene, available in bookstores everywhere.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. 20% of Iraq veterans who were in at least five firefights are suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, according to a new study by the New England Journal of Medicine. PTSD is debilitating, causing headaches, sleeplessness, hypervigilance, and depression. The disorder has plagued a total of 12.6% of soldiers returning from Iraq, and the chances of suffering from it only increases with the amount of time spent in combat zones.
How can contemporary America possibly compare with 1933 Germany? Find out in Tom Hartman's brand new fully illustrated book, We the People, A Call to Take Back America. Through Tom's concise political analysis and Neil Cohn's vibrant illustrations, you'll observe an unsettling, if not shocking, perspective of America. You'll also hear what the founders of this country did to control corporate power. You'll be invited to consider how the American political system can be made more democratic, as well as comprehend the project for the new American century's vision for America. Here's what syndicated cartoonist Ted Rawl said after reading We the People.
An ambitious effort to explain everything that's wrong in America, how things got this way, and what should be done about it. We the People is the product of a brilliant and principled thinker.
We the People, A Call to Take Back America by Tom Hartman. Available in bookstores everywhere.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
He used to carry his guitar in a gunny sack. Go sit beneath the tree by the railroad track. Bold engineer.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Thanks to Chuck in New Mexico for the reminder. Just gave us a shout. I had heard this on the news this morning. Doctors Without Borders. I forget the word for doctors in French, but, you know, sans frontières. Doctors Without Borders has pulled out of Afghanistan today. Five of their people have been assassinated. It's worth noting, by the way, that there are 5,000 French soldiers right now as part of the NATO and UN peacekeeping force in Afghanistan engaged in nation building. Oh, those French, they're just so terrible. They are helping us rebuild Afghanistan. Barack Obama talks about hope. Hope is something that we must have.
It's the hope of slaves sitting around a fire singing freedom songs. The hope of immigrants setting out for distant shores. The hope of a young naval lieutenant bravely patrolling the Mekong Delta. The hope of a mill worker's son who dares to defy the odds. The hope of a skinny kid with a funny name who believes that America has a place for him, too.
Of course, the skinny kid with a funny name being Barack Obama himself. His father came from Kenya. His mother, his father, an African, of course, from Kenya. And his mother, a white woman from Kansas. And both his parents he mentioned last night are now deceased. But he's really, this guy is amazing. It was one of the best presentations, I think, so far. Right up there. There have been several really great orators. And last night was no shortage. He talked about how John Kerry will not hesitate to use American force if necessary. And yet he understands that you don't use it unnecessarily. And a good point.
Be clear. Let me be clear. We have real enemies in the world. These enemies must be found, they must be pursued, and they must be defeated. John Kerry knows this. And just as Lieutenant Kerry did not hesitate to risk his life to protect the men who served with him in Vietnam, President Kerry will not hesitate one moment to use our military might to keep America safe and secure.
And that was
Kerry believes in America.
A major applause line. And
there are those who are preparing to divide us.
Yeah. What are the spinmeisters going to do now? How are they going to spin this stuff? Has anybody on, right-wing radio been talking about the real issues, for example, that Bill Clinton raised, or the real issues that Ted Kennedy raised last night? We'll be getting into a little later in the program.
The spin masters, the negative ad peddlers, who embrace the politics of anything goes. Well, I say to them tonight, there is not a liberal America and a conservative America. There is the United States of America. There is not a black America and a white America and Latino America and Asian America. There's the United States of America.
There's the United States of America. And this is, putting this in context, I mean, compare this with the story that we ran yesterday that Newt Gingrich just laid it out. Newt Gingrich comes out and says to the Republicans, he got a bunch of Republicans together, and he said, we need to be promoting wedge issues. Now, have you thought about what the word wedge means? What is a wedge? A wedge is something that you drive in between things to separate them. It's something you use to divide things. I mean, the probably the most well-known wedge that I used to use was to split wood, right? And you stick it in the wood, you pound it in with a maul or with a hammer, and it splits the wood. The wedge issues, and here's Newt Gingrich saying to the Republicans, and this one of the Republicans from Pennsylvania going, hey, we got some good wedge issues here, and he's saying, we polled out, we've got three wedge issues where 80% of the American voters say, yeah, that's cool, that's a good issue, I agree with that. And, let's split up. Let's divide America. Let's make people angry with each other. Let's make people hate each other. And the right-wingers say, and then they can have their political success, because a divided America is a confused America. And I think it's just marvelous the way the Democrats are saying, no, we just have one America here. And that it's an us, not a me, them. 29 after. For more than 27 years, the Progressive magazine In These Times has provided groundbreaking coverage of movements for social, environmental, and economic justice. Author and broadcast personality Studs Terkel calls In These Times his bi-weekly tonic. In These Times features award-winning reporting and analysis of national and international news. Find In These Times on your newsstand or visit us online at www.inthesetimes.com or call 1-800-827-0270. 1-800-827-0270.
Pop and not so pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
A system that will grant legal status to temporary workers who are here in the country working, that will increase the number of men and women on the path to American citizenship.
That was President George W. Bush speaking before a group of Latino voters earlier this month in San Antonio, Texas. He was promoting immigration reforms that would grant undocumented workers guest worker status so they could legally work in the United States. However, last week, White House officials asked Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist not to offer a bill that would do just that. The bill, sponsored by Republican Senator Larry E. Craig of Idaho, would help 500,000 farm workers gain legal residency. The bill died when the Senate adjourned until fall. The bill had the support of 63 senators, including 27 Republicans and 12 committee chairmen. Craig vowed to introduce the bill next session, which will give the president the opportunity to repeat this statement he made in Texas.
This proposal reflects the interest and best values of America, and Congress should pass it into law.
On Tuesday, during the Democratic National Convention, the Campaign for America's Future hosted a panel of speakers, including Michael Moore and Howard Dean. Former Secretary of Labor under Bill Clinton, Robert Reich, standing at a height of 4 feet 10 inches, spoke about how President Bush's tax cut doesn't help America's workers in a lagging economy.
Now, every time you hear them say and use the word average, watch your wallets. The basketball player Shaquille O'Neal and I have an average height of 6'1". It's just like the Bush tax cuts. They said that the average tax cut is $1,000. But Dick Cheney got a tax cut of $300,000. Most Americans are getting under $100 tax cuts.
A strike by the Illinois Secretary of State employees has been authorized if negotiations fall through. The workers, represented by the Service Employees International Union, could walk off the job as soon as August 16th if their demands aren't met. Secretary of State Jesse White has offered an 8% increase over 4 years, but with union members' pension payments at 4% of their salaries, it would actually only amount to a 4% increase stretched out over 4 years.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Feel like you're working yourself to death? You just might be. New research from Finland finds that work-related stress can double a person's risk of heart attack. Researchers at the University of Helsinki found that otherwise healthy workers who reported persistent stress due to heavy work demands and low job security were just as likely to fall victim to heart attacks as heavy smokers who do not exercise.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. 26 and a half minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Worse than Watergate, the secret presidency of George W. Bush, John W. Dean, the author. John Dean, I've got to tell you, you are one of my heroes. I am so pleased to welcome you to the program here today. I remember Watergate. In fact, I was a reporter back then for a radio station in Lansing,
45.
Michigan. Yeah, I'm 53, so I remember it well. And this is a marvelous book you've written. And before we get into it, and by the way, I've been following your stuff on FindLaw for a couple of years now. It seems like, and right. In fact, I
three or more, I think.
Yeah, and I may be wrong. I think I may have cited you in a book I wrote called Unequal Protection, which is mostly about the 1886 Santa Clara County case. But in any case, before we get into the book here, just two quick questions that I've been wanting to ask you for some time, kind of opinion things. The first, a legal opinion. I've heard so many people talk about the possibility You know, there's all this discussion going on in the White House a couple weeks ago that was leaked into the media about postponing the elections if there was a terror attack. And right. several people have suggested that provisions of the Patriot Act would make that possible, or other people have said that there was an executive order that Nixon signed, which you certainly would have known about, that makes that possible. And I've heard other people say, no, that's just paranoid conspiracy stuff. I figured you, of all people in the world, would know. What's the legal situation?
Obviously a fine law column you didn't look at, because that was my last column.
Oh, really?
On that subject.
Yeah, I haven't. I didn't.
I looked at it. At first, I looked at the rumor mill that was spreading the story and found it was really not. There was no basis in fact when I checked most of the sources.
Okay.
The other thing is, even more fundamentally, there is no law that would authorize the president or anybody else to cancel or postpone the election.
Yeah.
So what would happen if, and then what I did is I outlined the dangerous areas we have ahead because of the lack of leadership by this White House in trying to get some laws on the books that are needed to cover the contingency of if anything did happen. In other words, they're putting out information through Tom Ridge and others saying that the Al-Qaeda is clearly trying to do something to the democratic process during this election year, but yet they're not willing to adopt any of the necessary laws or anything else that will cover that situation. So it's a kind of awkward problem we've got.
So do you think if something happened, we might see something go on that's extra judicial? I mean, certainly in your book, there's no shortage of other things that they've done that are clearly against the law.
Well, the problem is, the closer you get to election day, or excuse me, yes, to election day first. If you have the greatest dangers are probably election day itself. Let's say terrorists started attacking polling places, which have absolutely no protection at all. They're in schools, libraries, public buildings, what have you, and they have no facility. And despite the fact of number of people recommending that something be done, nothing has been done. And terrorists could theoretically go to, say, target a number of swing states and just threaten the threat of people hearing the terrorist attack on polling places, they might not show up.
Right.
So that's one jeopardy. The next really serious problem comes after the election. I don't think the conventions are any problem. If anything happened at either of the conventions, there are plenty of time under the bylaws and charters of both the Republican and Democratic parties that they could get new candidates if that became necessary. If something happened to, say, either the president and the vice president or Kerry and Bush, Kerry and Edwards, there is time to replace that. But as I say, that becomes a problem, too, the closer you get to election day, because the parties have put no apparatus in place to deal effectively and swiftly with that problem if they should, say, lose a candidate. There's a mechanism in place, but that really doesn't have any expedited procedure. You have to use the entire national committees. With the Democrats, that's over 300 people. With the Republicans, about 150. Now, how quickly can they make a decision to find a new candidate if that's necessary? I don't know.
Yeah, it's a tough one. The other question I had was about the Supreme Court justices. I recall just before 2000, or in 2000, my recollection, both Sandra Day O'Connor and Rehnquist in various interviews on or off the record had essentially said that they wanted a Republican, or that if a Republican was elected, that being George W. Bush, that they would retire in the next term. They didn't, and I believe it was Rehnquist who said that he didn't want to retire during a Democratic administration. And
they have both strongly hinted that they would like to retire.
Yeah. Now neither of them have, though. Does that mean that they've taken a close look at George W. and they're scared to death of him appointing their predecessors? That they think he's even crazier than they are, and they're waiting, hoping that Kerry will get elected?
To the contrary, I think they're hoping that Bush will get reelected, and then he will appoint a conservative replacement.
Oh, that he'll have so much power then.
Well, he has the power to appoint anybody he wants. Whether he can get it confirmed by the Senate or not is another question.
Right. So in other words, they didn't want to. You're suggesting that they didn't. They haven't gone for a retirement because that would have thrown another red herring, or not red herring, another fresh meat for the Democrats if Bush appointed some real toxic conservative to replace one of them.
Well, Bush has said his role model for Supreme Court Justice
Thomas.
Is Antonin Scalia, and Clarence Thomas. So we have a pretty good idea of who and what kind of justice he'll appoint.
Yeah, pretty scary stuff. Well, in the 10 minutes we have here left, let's get into your book. You in Worse Than Watergate, which is just an absolutely remarkable book. We're talking with John W. Dean, former counsel to Richard Nixon, and the author of other books as well. Blind Ambition, telling about his time in the Nixon administration, The Rehnquist Choice, a biography of Warren G. Harding. But this book, Worse Than Watergate, The Secret Presidency of George W. Bush, on page 56, illegally hiding gubernatorial papers is his last act as governor of Texas. You talk about something that George W. Bush did that you didn't think was such a healthy thing, hiding his records?
Well, I didn't. And he's obviously done the same thing as president. He's currently trying to get a new head of the National Archives so he can, in essence, accomplish what he's accomplished in Texas, which is to keep his gubernatorial records pretty well buried. They did surface for a short while. What he did is he actually changed the law in Texas and then didn't comply with the law and sent his records off to his father's library to keep them buried. For a while, there were some reporters that were prowling around in them, but the National Archives, which runs Presidential Archives, said, hey, we don't have time to look at gubernatorial records of the president's son. They're being the library, his father's library, being federally controlled, if you will. And so the state librarian in Texas, Peggy Rude, objected to the procedures and the failure to follow the new law and prevailed and got them sent to Austin, where they were available for a short time. Some reporters got into them, got some pretty embarrassing stories out of them, and Bush, meanwhile, further interpreted the law through his hand-picked successor as governor, Governor Perry in Texas, who's now got the keys to the cabinet, still all those papers in his hands, and nobody's getting them anymore. But anyway, he's trying the same thing at the federal level, and this is just part of his penchant for secrecy, this being one of the many examples I lay out of the disposition of this presidency to keep everything buried.
Yeah, this is really meta to the larger issue, which is the topic of your book, The Secret Presidency of George W. Bush. The SEC investigation, both the SEC investigations of both Bush and Cheney, for example. Tell us about those.
Well, with Bush, it was his role in Harkin Industries, and they actually were able to get a hold of that. That happened while his father was president, and if the fix wasn't put in, they certainly gave a good appearance of it, because everybody who was involved in the investigation that went absolutely nowhere had a connection to either Bush Sr. or Bush Jr., and they just didn't take the investigation anywhere.
What a surprise!
That did not happen with Cheney, however.
Yeah.
Because what happened there is the investigation started down at a lower level, got into the SEC, is currently ongoing, although nothing has surfaced on it. It's been going on now for a couple of years. And what they're looking at is Cheney's role as chairman and CEO of Halliburton, and his accounting practices while there. But once they get their nose in that tent, I don't see how they can avoid looking at Cheney's insider trading. And by that I mean Cheney sold his shares of Halliburton when he became vice president, or the vice presidential candidate, at around $55 a share. He sold them, and he had to know at the time he sold them that there were something like 117,000 asbestos lawsuits against Halliburton. Actually, it was a subsidiary of a merger that Cheney had engineered.
Dresser.
That created a liability that was enormous. And when the public learned that Halliburton had these asbestos cases, the stock dropped to about $13 a share. You just can't trade your own shares without revealing that kind of inside information for the whole market to know. And I don't know how the SEC is not going to to look at what is almost the very definition of insider trading, is trading without kind of knowledge and not revealing it. So that is ongoing, and we'll see what happens.
So Dick Cheney, insider trading, George W. Bush. Now, I heard during the 2000 campaign Bush say that he had been investigated by the SEC and exonerated. And I understand his use of the word exonerated was just plain old flat-out lie.
A non-investigation is not exactly an exoneration. Yeah. As I say, because of the disposition of the people involved, one of the reasons I suspect they did not investigate it very thoroughly, it was not a very big deal.
Yeah.
But it's not unlike Martha Stewart, where they made a small deal into a huge cause celeb. They could have done that with Bush Jr. They didn't, while his father was president.
Well, she made $35,000 or something. He made $800,000. I mean, it's...
When you roll the whole thing out the way the thing pyramided up, yes, you know, he did very well.
Yeah. 1-866-889-8894 is our telephone number. If you don't mind, if we take a call from a listener,
after.
Is that all right with you? Okay. Michael in Atlanta is on the line. Hey, Michael, welcome to the program. You're talking to John Dean.
Hi, I'm glad to speak to you. I'm a big fan of John's, and I've read his book, Worse Than Watergate, and I think it's brilliant. And I had a question about something that you wrote in there.
Go ahead.
You mentioned in your book that the neocon movement seems to be infatuated with the political ideas of Leo Strauss.
Yeah.
I was wondering, you know, there's a lot of rumors about that particular political ideology infiltrating various political science departments around the country, and I was wondering how much you think this may have contributed to the neocon takeover of the GOP, for lack of a better word.
Good question, Michael.
The neoconservative movement is relatively small and has an enormous amount of influence given the size and the paucity of people involved in it. It truly is an intellectual movement. Strauss is an intellectual. His influence is probably does exist in some political science departments because of his stature as a political scientist and political philosopher. So I'm sure a lot of the conservative professors send out his books to be read. In fact, I actually have right on my desk a copy of a book called Leo Strauss, What is Political Philosophy? I was reading some passages from it, looking deeper into some of his thought. The influence of the neocons, however, has really come in through Dick Cheney. He and Rumsfeld opened the door. I don't think either Rumsfeld or Cheney themselves are what you would call a neoconservative, but they did open the door for them, and as a result, they've adopted a lot of their policies.
Yeah. And through
their influence has really been quite enormous and, to me, quite negative.
And through the Project for a New American Century as well.
You
note in your book that George Bush, and thank you for the call, Michael, and the question, you note in your book that George Bush committed a criminal offense by launching his war in Iraq the way that he did it. That's a strong charge. We've got about 2 minutes left here.
Not only a criminal offense, it's a high crime and misdemeanor under the Constitution.
Okay.
Let me give it to you in a nutshell, is that he asked for a resolution from Congress to go to war in Iraq, very unusual delegation of power in advance of actually exercising it. The Congress said, okay, we'll give it to you with two conditions. One, that you give us a formal presidential determination that there was no diplomatic means with which to resolve the weapons of mass destruction issue, and secondly, that it's consistent with the war on terrorism. In other words, the two basic arguments that Bush has been making for war being that there were weapons of mass destruction and there's an al-Qaeda connection. Well, after he went to war in March when he made his determination, the document that he sent to Congress is about as close to a blatant presidential fraud is anything I've ever seen come out of the White House. I lay it out in some detail in non-legalese in the book to explain to people exactly how blatant this violation is and how absurd it is. And it's really quite remarkable that nobody's ever looked at it.
You think Ramsey Clark, who signed this full-page ad in the Boston Globe yesterday calling for the impeachment of Bush, then is right in the 20, 30 seconds we have left?
Well, you know, a lot of people have tried to get me to argue for impeaching Bush. I lay out, in fact, in the book that he has committed an impeachable offense, but I think that given how political an impeachment process is, that no one's going to impeach him. First of all, no one's going to realistically do it while the Republicans control House, Senate, and the White House. It's not going to happen.
So it's just not practical.
Secondly, we are in a time where what impeachment accomplishes can be done at the polls.
There you go. John W. Dean.
Proceed with impeachment at this point.
Thank you. John W. Dean, the author of Worse Than Watergate, The Secret Presidency of George W. Bush. John Dean, thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
How can there be hope when millions starve in a world of plenty? How can there be justice when the rich parade their wealth before the poor? How can there be peace when each man is his neighbor's enemy? In a world of chaos, peace is possible, but only if we address the root causes of our global crisis, poverty, hunger, and despair. We must share the world's resources to create justice. Without justice, there can be no peace. Fortunately, we're not alone in our efforts. According to futurist Benjamin Krem, a group of enlightened teachers led by Maitreya, the world teacher, is here to inspire a new approach based on the principle of sharing. With their guidance, we can transform the world and create a peaceful future for all. For a free audio CD of an extraordinary lecture by Benjamin Krem on the emergence of the teachers, call toll-free 888-242-8272. Again, that's 888-242-8272.
Hi, this is Tom Hartman. Join me this October as we explore Greece, the ancient birthplace of democracy. When the Founding Fathers were searching for the best and fairest form of government, they studied the models of Athenian democracy. We'll explore together this part of the ancient world where the ideas that today animate modern democracy were first worked out. This journey is set on the shore of the sparkling Mediterranean Sea with the sacred mountains of Crete behind us. We'll visit the ancient site of Gortian, famous for the Law Code of Gortian, large 6th century BC tablets of stone built into a wall and one of the first examples of laws ever written down and now the oldest still in existence. I'll teach workshops at the two most important sites in all of Crete, Knossos and Phaistos, plus more. At Knossos, we'll experience the main ceremonial center and the palace of King Minos. For information on how you can join us on this trip of a lifetime, visit www.tomhartman.com or call 1-800-234-TOUR. That's 1-800-234-TOUR, T-O-U-R.
Tom Hartman will be speaking out in Santa Fe, New Mexico with We the People, a call to take back America, a Friday evening talk August 27th at the Santa Fe Armory for the Arts, to be followed by a Saturday, August 28th workshop called Waking Up to Personal and Global Transformation. Tom Hartman brings his wit, wisdom, and intelligence to Santa Fe the weekend of August 27th and 28th. Tom Hartman will discuss with us how America faces its greatest threat since a civil war. And Tom Hartman will look at how Western thinking, legends, and myths have caused global problems and endangered democracy and what we can do about it. To get your tickets and more information, call 505-988-2223 in Santa Fe. That's 505-988-2223 or visit greatmystery.org. Tickets for Tom Hartman are also available at Collected Works Bookstore in Santa Fe.
With the Workers Independent News Service, I'm Sarah Turner bringing you today's feature story. Recently, a group of workers gathered in the Garment District in New York City to launch the Ain't I a Woman campaign, a national boycott against Liberty Apparel. Rebecca Miles was there.
The campaign demands that the manufacturer be accountable to their subcontracted workers. In 1999, 26 garment workers sued Liberty Apparel for sweatshop conditions in their U.S. contracted factories and failure to pay minimum wage. Many workers, when paid, were earning $3 an hour. Anna Chong from the Ain't I a Woman campaign.
It's been 5 years. For 5 years, they still refuse to pay their workers. Their kids are grown and they have not received a single cent. By not paying these workers, they're actually trying to change the law. They're actually trying to change the Fair Labor Standards Act. And because this will affect workers across the country, this boycott is also about holding all manufacturers accountable and all companies. companies that subcontract accountable and for them to stop hiding behind the subcontracting system.
What concerns workers is the increase in subcontracting, especially where subcontractors are not accountable when accidents happen on the job, or where the company suddenly disappears when there is any kind of protest, as in the case of Liberty Apparel and its subcontractor. David Ting, a high school student whose mother worked long hours in a nail salon.
The subcontracting system, it's not limited to the garment industry. White-collar workers such as lawyers and paralegals are employed through temp agencies. And although they are well paid, they have absolutely no control of their working hours and may work for years without contract.
We were unable to contact Liberty Apparel Company as the line was constantly busy. Their clothing line is sold in outlets like Conway and Family Dollar for families on tight incomes. And ironically, is durable clothing for workers and hunters. For the Workers' Independent News Service, I'm Rebecca Miles in New York.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I was riding the subway with 1,000 New Yorkers headed downtown.
Welcome back.
An old woman shoved over. She made room for me to sit down.
Yeah, we need to be taking care of each other in this nation. Not in some, like, you know, nanny state. The favorite phrase of the cons to say, well, we the people have no business taking care of we the people, but really we do. I mean, we've decided we're going to protect ourselves from crime, and so we collectively get together and we have a police department that we all pay for and that serves us all. And we'd really rather not have our houses burned down, and so we have a fire department, and we'd really like to have streets, you know, that we can drive on to get from place to place, and we're willing to all pay for that. And it wouldn't it be a good idea if our kids were well educated. Yes, we're willing to pay for that too, because the benefits of society are so great. And Ron Reagan last night was suggesting that with regard to stem cell research, that, you know, whether we're going to pay for it or not, at least we shouldn't be stopping it. This is taking, you know, people go in to have into a fertility clinic. Woman gets a bunch of eggs taken out of her ovaries. They put them on a petri dish, put some sperm in there. Thousands of them get fertilized. They pluck out two or three of them and implant them in her womb. Those are going to become a child. You know, one of those is going to become a child. The rest of them sitting on the dish there, they'll multiply to, you know, 2 cells, 4 cells, 8 cells, 16 cells, geometrically up to, you know, a few hundred cells. And at that point, they're still undifferentiated. And you stop the multiplication at that point, and you now have cells that can become any tissue in the body. And if you take out that woman and man's DNA and you put in your DNA, those cells can become a new liver for you or a new heart for you or a new pancreas for you. And Ron Reagan says, what's wrong with that kind of research? Those cells are going to be thrown into the trash anyway.
A few of these folks, needless to say, are just grinding a political axe, and they should be ashamed of themselves.
Though these folks, of course, being people who say, oh no, you can't have embryonic stem cell research.
Many are well-meaning and sincere. Their belief is just that, an article of faith, and they are entitled to it. But it does not follow that the theology of a few should be allowed to forestall the health and well-being of the many.
Very straightforward.
And how can we affirm life if we abandon those whose own lives are so desperately at risk?
Well said. Ron Reagan last night at the Democratic National Convention in Boston. Stick around. We're going to have a few more clips. I've got Ted Kennedy, John Kennedy, Teresa Hines Carey. Hey, did you hear about the new records on Bush's military service? We'll tell you about those. As the Tom Hartman Program continues, you are right smack dab in the middle of a vast radical middle conspiracy. Stick around.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
The Tom
Founding fathers thought they'd stop corporations from ever overthrowing elected government. Little did they know that 200 years later, democracy would be stolen and twisted in the name of so-called conservative values. Hi, this is Tom Hartman. The founders of America fought the Revolutionary War against the excessive corporate power of the East India Company, and presidents from Jefferson to Eisenhower warned us that extremely big businesses could destroy democracy. You'll find this extraordinary American story in my book, Unequal Protection: The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights. It starts with the Boston Tea Party and ends with the rampant corruption of the Bush administration. It tells the dramatic story of how corporations hijacked the Bill of Rights, setting the stage for the CEO takeover of America. And it shows how we can take America back, and tells the stories of Americans from Pennsylvania to California who are doing just that right now.
Unequal Protection is available in bookstores nationwide, and you can read several chapters online at unequalprotection.com. That's Unequal Protection by Tom Hart.
Pop and not so pop culture, democracy and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
A system that will grant legal status to temporary workers who are here in the country working, that'll increase the number of men and women on the path to American citizenship.
That was President George W. Bush speaking before a group of Latino voters earlier this month in San Antonio, Texas. He was promoting immigration reforms that would grant undocumented workers guest worker status so they could legally work in the United States. However, last week, White House officials asked Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist not to offer a bill that would do just that. The bill, sponsored by Republican Senator Larry E. Craig of Idaho, would help 500,000 farm workers gain legal residency. The bill died when the Senate adjourned until fall. The bill had the support of 63 senators, including 27 Republicans and 12 committee chairmen. Craig vowed to introduce the bill next session, which will give the president the opportunity to repeat this statement he made in Texas.
This proposal reflects the interest and best values of America, and Congress should pass it into law.
On Tuesday, during the Democratic National Convention, the Campaign for America's Future hosted a panel of speakers, including Michael Moore and Howard Dean. Former Secretary of Labor under Bill Clinton, Robert Reich, standing at a height of 4 feet 10 inches, spoke about how President Bush's tax cut doesn't help America's workers in a lagging economy.
Now, every time you hear them say and use the word average, watch your wallets. The basketball player Shaquille O'Neal and I have an average height of 6'1". It's just like the Bush tax cuts. They said that the average tax cut is $1,000. But Dick Cheney got a tax cut of $300,000. Most Americans are getting under $100 tax cuts.
A strike by the Illinois Secretary of State employees has been authorized if negotiations fall through. The workers, represented by the Service Employees International Union, could walk off the job as soon as August 16th if their demands aren't met. Secretary of State Jesse White has offered an 8% increase over 4 years. But with union members' pension payments at 4% of their salaries, it would actually only amount to a 4% increase stretched out over 4 years.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Feel like you're working yourself to death? You just might be. New research from Finland finds that work-related stress can double a person's risk of heart attack. Researchers at the University of Helsinki found that otherwise healthy workers who reported persistent stress due to heavy work demands and low job security were just as likely to fall victim to heart attacks as heavy smokers who do not exercise.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You put in 30 years at the company. You got good pay, health care. Then they send you a job overseas. And under George Bush, the company actually gets a tax break for doing it. Now, Bush says we're in recovery. Then after a year, you finally land another job. And you wonder, is this what you worked your whole life for? We're not being led. We're being misled.
In 2000, we had Florida's obscure Secretary of State, Catherine Harris, working to squirrel the presidential election. And now, look out, here comes another obscure GOP operative acting all squirrely about the 2004 presidential election. DeForest Soares Jr., a former New Jersey Secretary of State, was handpicked by George W. a couple of years ago to chair the U.S. Election Assistance Commission, which is supposed to assist state election officials. Instead, Soares is out to assist Bush. He sent a letter to Homeland Security Czar Tom Ridge saying that emergency authority was needed to let the Bushites cancel a presidential election in the event of a terrorist threat. Rather than hurling this misguided missive into the trash can and suggesting the Soares get professional help, Ridge is actually acting on it. He has called in John Ashcroft to determine what legal steps would be needed to suspend this fall's election. The rationalization is that evil terrorists could strike or threaten to strike the U.S. just before an election, so the Homeland Czar needs the power to cancel the balloting and schedule it for a later day or year or whenever. Now, guess who issues our color-coded warnings about terrorist threat levels? Tom Ridge. Indeed, just to punctuate his extreme request to Ashcroft, Ridge promptly issued yet another of his vague code yellow warnings that Al-Qaeda is planning a large-scale attack on America, adding darkly that this attack will be, quote, an effort to disrupt the democratic process. How convenient. If Bush is losing and needs an October surprise, Ridge could issue a code red alarm, using it to justify a postponement of the vote. This is Jim Hightower saying, if there's an actual terrorist attack, that's when Americans will most want and need a chance to vote on the officials who have failed to protect us. In no event should we ever empower the incumbents to disrupt the democratic process. I'm Jim Hightower, and I've approved this message.
Jim Hightower is not running for office, but he is back this campaign season with an important word about the regime of King George W.
Let's stop beating around the bush. These people are nuts.
Let's Stop Beating Around the Bush is Hightower's hilarious new best-selling book, offering you unvarnished facts, insight, and humor to get you through this year's political spin cycle. Buy Let's Stop Beating Around the Bush today and make politics fun again. Available at bookstores everywhere and on the web at jimhightower.com. Buy it today.
38%.
46%.
42%.
I cut my payments in half.
How much can you cut your monthly student loan payments by refinancing with College Loan Corporation? To find out, just call 1-800-2-COLLEGE. You'll quickly be connected to an expert loan consultant who will answer your questions and tell you how you can cut your monthly payment by up to 50% by refinancing your federal student loans at rates as low as 2.63%. 1-800-2-COLLEGE. It's the smartest call you can...
He's the man who uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here, broadcasting live coast to coast, border to border, on radio stations in California to North Carolina. Beaming down from outer space in the Sirius satellite system, streaming around the planet on RadioPower.org and Cable Radio Network. And now on CRN Channel 1, beaming, strangely enough, into 26 million homes via cable TV systems, yeah? So, growing every day here. Welcome back, SOAR winners! SOAR winners? Could it be that these guys who kind of steal elections and win, you know. John Powers has written a remarkable book. John Powers, he's the critic at large for NPR's Fresh Air, deputy editor of LA Weekly, writes a weekly media column there called On, and an international correspondent at Gourmet. He's written a book called SOAR Winners and the Rest of Us in George Bush's America. John Powers, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Yes. Hello, Tom.
Glad to have you here. John, why SOAR winners?
Well, actually, the interesting thing about SOAR winners is that we live in a society, as you well know, that's increasingly divided between people who are winners and then the rest of us.
Who are losers?
What's interesting about our particular moment in history is that we actually don't simply have winners and the rest of us, but the winners behave so badly. They're SOAR winners.
How so?
Over the rest of us.
How so?
Well, I think you can see it every day. In politics, you actually have a president who thinks that you're actually wrong. It even offends him if you might question what he's doing. You have business leaders like Donald Trump for whom "you're fired" becomes a catchphrase. You actually see in daily life the way that the powerful people expect to live in a different America than the rest of us. people behave badly. You know, Donald Rumsfeld is a sore winner. Bill O'Reilly's a sore winner. Here's a millionaire who's angry all the time. He feels aggrieved and ill-treated by the world, even as he's making millions and millions of dollars.
But, John Powers, there's nothing new about this. I mean, kings and queens have lived like this, behaved like this forever. Isn't the celebrity fixation in America perhaps an extension of the historical, some would probably argue, human characteristic to want to have kings and queens? And in our nation, our president is both the head of government, he's the prime minister, and he's the head of state. He's the king, or the equivalent, you know, of in the U.K., and so there's our king, and but we really don't have a king. So let's have some movie stars too, and let's have some, you know, Bill O'Reilly and Rush. Anyway, isn't this?
You're absolutely right, Tom. Obviously, there have been people with power throughout all of history.
Yeah.
What's interesting about America at this particular moment is that America has traditionally thought of itself as a country where this isn't true.
Yeah.
But at the moment, we not only have, as you say, political leaders who are, I think, who use their power in an angrier way than they've used it in my lifetime. You have economic leaders who, in fact, will take the huge bonuses as they're firing people and feel justified.
Yeah.
But you also have that level of celebrity culture where millions and millions of Americans are made to feel that their lives don't matter, because, in fact, what you see in the media all the time are the stories of rich, powerful, or famous celebrities.
Yeah, John Powers, author of Sore Winners. John, it seems to me, looking back on the years that I've been on this planet, that this really started with Reagan's presidency. Jimmy Carter was into wearing, you know, sweaters in the White House. I mean, if you go back in history, of course, George Washington was kind of ambivalent. He didn't. There was actually John Adams that originally suggested that we call him his Highness President George, right? And Washington would have nothing to do with that. And Adams turned the presidency into this, you know, pomp and ceremony. In fact, he had this carriage that whenever he traveled, any city he traveled through, they had to fire cannons and shout, "Long live President John Adams and his wife." And in one village in Trenton, New Jersey, there was a guy in a bar. This was after the Alien and Sedition Acts had been passed, who was drunk, and he said, "Oh, they're firing the cannons. Hopefully they'll hit him in the arse." And they arrested him. Adams had him arrested and thrown in prison. And Thomas Jefferson pardoned him when he became president in 1800. Jefferson then walked to the White House, you know, didn't do the carriage, used to answer the door in his slippers. In fact, people very often, when Jefferson answered the door of the White House, people thought he was a servant, you know, because he wasn't all dressed up. And so, there, you know, there's that contrast back then, and we're seeing it again. Even Eisenhower and even Nixon to a large extent, and Kennedy was a little more flash, but all of them, I think, had kind of this relatively casual thing. And then Reagan came along, and suddenly the White House was pomp and ceremony and glitz, and it pretty much has been ever since, hasn't it?
Well, it has been. I mean, I think the thing that happened with Reagan was that an aspect of celebrity and stardom entered the White House.
Right.
If you think of his governing style, which was in fact a divisive governing style, nevertheless, his personal style was actually that of a good winner. Hmm. He was actually pushing things through that would actually help the well-off people. But at the same time, he actually seemed friendly. What you now get in the Bush years, which is interesting, is you get essentially the same Ronald Reagan policies, but by people who aren't any good at actually smoothing over what they're doing.
Yeah.
So that, you know, I often say that George Bush, you know, who generously put, scraped by winning the election, is like the CEO of a company who outbids his rivals by a dime, and now thinks and now says, "I own the country. If you don't like it, too bad." That's the essence of the sore winner thing. Reagan was actually a much slipperier character to deal with because he always seemed friendly as he was pushing through divisive policies. Bush doesn't seem friendly, which is actually one reason why there's so much opposition to him.
Yeah. I thought one of the great stories in here was when you were in Ho Chi Minh City, HCMC.
Yes.
And this kid is coming up to you going, "Gangri, Gangri, you know, do you want Gangri?" And it turns out it was Graham Greene. And he was offering to sell you a bootleg copy of The Quiet American. What's the metaphor? That story is meta to this larger issue of, you know, kind of the "why do they hate us" blues. You want to talk about that for a moment?
Oh, sure, yes. No, what struck me, you know, it was a very cool thing to have this kid selling the book. But what struck me when I got the book was that the famous book about Vietnam,
right,
where America was trapped for so many years fighting this desperate war, the book itself was written by an Englishman.
Right.
And in fact, one of the interesting and unfortunate things about American culture at the moment is that we are one of the most insular countries in the world. We have the capacity to, basically to go anywhere, to know everything, yet Americans know shockingly little about the outside world, so that when September 11th happened, you actually had people wondering, you know, why would these people hate us so much? Well, the truth is that it's not that we deserve to be the victims of a terror attack, but if you actually looked out in the world, you would realize lots of people out there dislike America for all sorts of reasons, you know, and America had done all sorts of things in the world that can provoke dislike. Yet Americans, you know, not only don't know it, they live in the most media-wired country on the planet, and yet it's almost impossible in the mainstream to find the kind of information about the outside world that you routinely get if you go to another country. I mean, if I can give one example.
Sure.
Today I was watching CNN. You know, what has happened today is there was a massive car bomb explosion in Iraq.
Right.
That's killed, you know, maybe 70 people. I was watching CNN for an hour, and they didn't mention this, but they did manage to show the photo op that John Kerry was having arriving in Boston and have discussions of last night's political speeches. But in an hour, the cable news network didn't mention what is actually happening in Iraq because it slipped off the front pages. And that's a war we're involved in. Yeah. You can only imagine how we cover places that we're not involved in so directly.
Yeah, like Sudan. And for example, I mean, you know, Saddam or Osama bin Laden. See, George Bush has got me doing it now. Osama bin Laden back before 9/11 when he issued his declaration of war against the United States, which was reprinted in the New York Times in 97, 98, something like that, just came right out and said that it was our foreign policy that he hated. It had nothing to do with our freedoms. He was upset because we were, he felt that we were propping up a corrupt regime in Saudi Arabia in order to suck dry the resources of that country at a low, low price. And that in addition to that, since 1991, we had had infidels, we had had men who drank alcohol and women who were not veiled and were allowed to drive cars on holy ground because we had built this Air Force base in 91, Prince Bandar or whatever it is, Air Force base, in Saudi Arabia. And he was like, get out of Saudi Arabia and stop propping up this corrupt regime in Saudi Arabia and other places. He pointed to other countries. And that just, like, never gets talked about, that our foreign policy, which is driven by our addiction to cheap oil, which is driven by the oil industry being in bed with our government, because if we were to simply eliminate the SUV exemption from CAFE standards, from fleet mileage standards, and raise fleet mileage standards by 3 miles per gallon in the United States, we would not need to import any oil at all from the Middle East. We could walk away from it. And yet those, I mean, it never gets discussed in the mainstream media. Never gets discussed.
No, that never gets discussed. You know, and you know what I find fascinating about it is that that's the case where all the connections are explicit.
Yeah.
You know, if you look around the rest of the world, you know, even where America is behaving, you know, perfect, you know, not in any way violently or badly, we are by far the most powerful country in the world, and what we do with our economic policies affects the lives of billions and billions of people. And yet somehow we live in a country where even as we're doing this, we have no idea that when we make some sort of decision in one part of the world, it might actually affect the lives of people living in Singapore or Malaysia or Taiwan.
Yeah.
That, in fact, they live in a world that we are so powerful in that all of our decisions are important, and yet we don't seem to be interested, or at least we're not allowed to be interested, in what is actually going on in those places where all these things are happening.
Yeah, and you know what's odd to me, John, is that many of our decisions impact the world negatively, but we are doing a lot of very good things in the world as well. I've traveled all around this planet over the last 25 years. I have done international relief work for an organization based in Germany. And our, you know, we actually, America, there are a lot of places in the world where we're really loved and we're really appreciated, and that is not known by most Americans either. I mean, it's just jingoism. You define five characters that you said George Bush has played, that he portrays. Real Shady Slim, the wise CEO, the compassionate conservative, Prince Hal, and W the Dope. Got about a minute and a half left. Can you give me a take on one of those or wrap them up for us?
Okay, sure. You know, the basic idea here is that whenever the media is presenting a president, they do a bunch of myths, Bush has gone through several of them. He started off as a regular guy, which of course he isn't. He has some regular guy style, but he's the son of a president. He's a millionaire. Then he became W the Dope. He's actually not a dope. He's incurious. You know, in the last election, the dope was Al Gore, who actually blew the election while Bush was actually being very cagey. You have Bush, the CEO, who's actually probably the closest to what he actually is because he does embody corporate values. And then finally you have Prince Hal, which is kind of the glorious new version of Bush that was created after 9/11, where he went from being this kind of mediocre guy that no one took very seriously to all of a sudden having to become the great king of America. And, you know, following the Shakespeare model, Essentially Bush was promoted from being sort of an ordinary kind of mediocre politician to being this great wartime leader.
Yeah. An Arthurian legend.
Yes.
Yeah, John Power is the author of Sore Winners and the Rest of Us in George Bush's America, a book, a fine, extraordinary book you can find in bookstores near you and online. John, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Talk to you again. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 20 minutes past the hour. Stick around.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates lock out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
I'm sorry. There's nothing more we can do. No one wants to hear those devastating words from a doctor. But that's what millions of Americans suffering from diseases like Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and diabetes will be told if you vote for Ralph Nader. Americans who voted for Nader put Bush in the White House in 2000. As president, George W. put the brakes on embryonic stem cell research, which could lead to revolutionary new treatments and cures. John Kerry vows to push this research forward. George W. Bush is still taking orders from the religious right. He wants to stifle stem cell research. This time, don't help him. Don't vote for Ralph. The Committee for the Advancement of Stem Cell Research approved this message. It was not approved by any candidate, nor any candidate's committee. Visit CASCR.org.
At last, there's a positive focus on a condition that affects millions. Read The Edison Gene, ADHD and the Gift of the Hunter Child by Tom Hartman, best-selling author of Attention Deficit Disorder, A Different Perception. John Rady, author of User's Guide to the Brain, says this about the Edison Gene.
Once again, with tireless scholarship and a bit of poetry, Tom Hartman helps take us to the edge of knowing ourselves, our brains, and our world.
The Edison Gene, available in bookstores everywhere.
Hey, what does this word make you think of? Tchaikovsky.
Isn't it? So what's the word?
No, that is the word.
He loves me.
All right, who's Martha Graham?
She invented the graham cracker. Before her, there was only soda crackers.
Maybe they're not getting enough art. Kids who participate in the arts do better in school and in life. To learn more, visit AmericansForTheArts.org. Because all kids should get to appreciate Tchaikovsky's music and Martha Graham's dance. Art. Ask for more. A public service message brought to you by Americans for the Arts and the Ad Council.
In the foreword to Tom Hartman's book, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, The Fate of the World and What We Can Do Before It's Too Late, renowned author Joseph Chilton Pierce writes,
"To discover brilliant, innovative, creative, and original thinking is one of life's rare privileges. To discover that such a thinker has focused on the most critical of all issues facing our species is encouraging. Because The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight is a seminal work offering a viewpoint original yet ancient, I see our situation today in a new light. And because of the scope and depth of this work, I find it inspiring as well as disturbing. I rather exhausted superlative in praise of Tom Hartman's book, The Prophet's Way, which I rightly called the most important book I've ever read. But now I find this sequel calling for equal praise, since the issue here addresses the whole of our species, and indeed all species.
The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, The Fate of the World and What We Can Do Before It's Too Late by Tom Hartman, in bookstores everywhere.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Our program brought to you today by the Committee for the Advancement of Stem Cell Research. You can visit them at www.cascr. Futurist Benjamin Krim, you can call for a free tape, 888-242-8272. And Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX. That's 511-6227. And thank you to our sponsors. Amazing stuff going on. The Democratic National Convention, Teddy Kennedy last night just really, really raised some stuff for me. His speech reminded me so much of some of the things that his older brother, one of his older brothers, Jack Kennedy, had said. Here's Teddy. He's now 70, I believe he's 72 or 74 years old. And so Jack must, you know, if he was still alive, would be well into his 80s now, I believe. And just he starts out talking about the old system of kings, you know, that we used to, that the American experiment was about not having kings anymore. System, you know, the three classic tyrannies, the feudal lords ruled by the rich, theocracies ruled by the religious, and kingdoms ruled by those who wield power. And Kennedy comments on that.
It was no accident that Massachusetts was founded as a commonwealth, a place where authority begins not to a single ruler, but to the people themselves.
There you go. And the word commonwealth, the wealth, the commonwealth. There are things that we are going to hold in common, and we're going to care for them. There, you know, our air, our water, our roads, our police department, our education system, our fire department, and of course, you know, the conservatives, so much of this stuff they want to just toss out. Anyhow, back to Teddy Kennedy.
Join together for the common good. The old system was based on inequality. Loyalty was demanded, never earned. Leaders ruled by fear, by force, by special favors for the few. Under the old unequal system, the quality of your connections mattered more than the content of your character. Your voices were not heard. Your concerns did not matter. Your votes did not count.
A particularly poignant note there.
The colonists knew they could do better, just as we know we can do better today. But only if we all work together.
And that, you know, only if we all work together, that the call, as it were, to the Democrats there. You know, let's unite, let's pull together, let's make this thing work. And then he said, you know, and then he evoked this notion that the Tiananmen Square vision. And this is such a powerful. I mean, here you had people in Tiananmen Square who literally marched to their death carrying a 36-foot-tall papier-mâché statue of the Statue of Liberty. They renamed the Goddess of Democracy, quoting Thomas Jefferson, as Kennedy points out.
The ideals of our founders still resonate across the globe. Young people in other lands, inspired by the liberty we cherish, linked arms and sang, "We shall overcome." When the Berlin Wall fell, when apartheid ended in South Africa, and when the courageous protest took place in Tiananmen Square, the goals of the American people are every bit as high as they were more than 200 years ago. If America is failing to reach them today, it's not because our ideals need replacing, it's because our president needs replacing.
A bit of a classic comment there, and really this was the call that Kennedy was making last night, and that so many of the other speakers were making at the Democratic convention, was the idea of a return to idealism, a return to community, a return to the idea of America as one nation together, working together, having a shared vision, an inclusive vision, a vision of a better country and a better world for all of us. And, you know, well, it would be nice if they could pull it off. It would be nice to go back to that vision of America that I think traditionally we have so often held. And hopefully it can happen. 29 minutes past the hour. For more than 27 years, the Progressive magazine In These Times has provided groundbreaking coverage of movements for social, environmental, and economic justice. Author and broadcast personality Studs Terkel calls In These Times his bi-weekly tonic. In These Times features award-winning reporting and analysis of national and international news. Find In These Times on your newsstand or visit us online at www.inthesetimes.com or call 1-800-827-0270. 1-800-827-0270.
Pop and not so pop culture, democracy and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
A system that will grant legal status to temporary workers who are here in the country working, that will increase the number of men and women on the path to American citizenship.
That was President George W. Bush speaking before a group of Latino voters earlier this month in San Antonio, Texas. He was promoting immigration reforms that would grant undocumented workers guest worker status so they could legally work in the United States. However, last week, White House officials asked Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist not to offer a bill that would do just that. The bill, sponsored by Republican Senator Larry E. Craig of Idaho, would help 500,000 farm workers gain legal residency. The bill died when the Senate adjourned until fall. The bill had the support of 63 senators, including 27 Republicans and 12 committee chairmen. Craig vowed to introduce the bill next session, which will give the president the opportunity to repeat this statement he made in Texas.
This proposal reflects the interest and best values of America, and Congress should pass it into law.
On Tuesday, during the Democratic National Convention, the Campaign for America's Future hosted a panel of speakers, including Michael Moore and Howard Dean. Former Secretary of Labor under Bill Clinton, Robert Reich, standing at a height of 4 feet 10 inches, spoke about how President Bush's tax cut doesn't help America's workers in a lagging economy.
Now, every time you hear them say and use the word average, watch your wallets. The basketball player Shaquille O'Neal and I have an average height of 6'1". It's just like the Bush tax cuts. They said that the average tax cut is $1,000. But Dick Cheney got a tax cut of $300,000. Most Americans are getting under $100 tax cuts.
A strike by the Illinois Secretary of State employees has been authorized if negotiations fall through. The workers, represented by the Service Employees International Union, could walk off the job as soon as August 16th if their demands aren't met. Secretary of State Jesse White has offered an 8% increase over 4 years. But with union members' pension payments at 4% of their salaries, it would actually only amount to a 4% increase stretched out over 4 years.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Feel like you're working yourself to death? You just might be. New research from Finland finds that work-related stress can double a person's risk of heart attack. Researchers at the University of Helsinki found that otherwise healthy workers who reported persistent stress due to heavy work demands and low job security were just as likely to fall victim to heart attacks as heavy smokers who do not exercise.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. In their rabid fervor to attack John Edwards. The Republican National Committee and its minions are going after trial lawyers. Oh, those nasty trial lawyers. How dare they defend average people against large multinational corporations? It's just wrong. However, it seems that there are a few Republicans who apparently don't think so. For example, Republican of Utah Orrin Hatch is a former trial lawyer. Senator Jeff Sessions, Republican of Alabama, was a trial lawyer in a state where juries have awarded numerous multi-million dollar verdicts in plaintiffs' cases. Saxby Chambliss of Georgia, the only member of the United States Senate who didn't actually win his seat, in my opinion, brags about trial lawyers who support him. He kind of likes them. Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican of South Carolina, a former trial lawyer, actually went out and asked the White House to stop picking on trial lawyers. He called Edwards a great guy. So 2 weeks later, Vice President Cheney says, Lindsey Graham's doing a great job for the people of South Carolina, and then launches into a tirade against, guess who, trial lawyers. Lindsey Graham had to be turning a little pink there. Governor Jeb Bush has said that he's going to, and I quote, whack, end quote, the trial lawyers, quote, even some Republicans say making trial lawyers the boogeyman of this year's election may prove difficult. It was the Gainesville, Florida Sun that said that, not Bush. Bush said he was going to whack them, and then the newspaper there says it may be difficult. The reason why, because the main GOP contender in Florida is Mel Martinez, the former Bush cabinet secretary, a successful trial lawyer who was president of the Florida Academy of Trial Lawyers. But somehow, I guarantee you, somehow, the Republicans will figure out how to have their cake and eat it too. How to kind of cover up the fact that there are a lot of Republicans who are trial lawyers, some very successful ones, and that really, I mean, you know, the defining case, for example, of John Edwards, this suit in 1993, a little 5-year-old girl. I mean, this is just a brilliant case. Hey, Ellen Ratner's on the line with us, the Talk Radio News Service bureau chief and Washington reporter. Hey, Ellen, welcome.
Well, thank you very much. You know, one of the things that I think we're going to see, Tom, is that when Theresa Hines Carey becomes First Lady, they are going to make more mincemeat of her than they ever thought of making with Hillary Rodham Clinton.
You realize? I mean, they've already started.
They have.
These guys love to bash people's wives. I mean, that's like the Republican thing, you know, go after politicians' wives. Excuse me.
Right, but because she leaves herself so open to it, and even though I think in some respects she's more savvy than Hillary Clinton was in the beginning, they are really going. I mean, they are already starting. I know because I've talked to some Republicans who are already preparing. They're not even doing the talking points now. They're waiting in the wings.
Sure. Well, that's the thing. If you can't win on the issues, do character assassination. I mean, isn't that their strategy?
The other thing is it's so interesting. I've been talking about this since the beginning of the week about how the Democrats have essentially closed ranks. Obama gave a great speech, and he, you know, there's no question it was one of the great oratories. I think I was in the room at the time it happened.
Yeah.
But the guy is for the death penalty. He's not great on gay marriage. I mean, I'm confused here. I thought we were, you know, a Democratic Party that was a little bit more open on some issues.
Well, he's a centrist. I mean, he's a moderate Democrat. He's what probably 30 years ago would have been called a Rockefeller Republican.
Exactly. But, you know, as I think I explained to you, I have seen wealthy lefty funders at events, and I say to them, what are you doing this for? Well, you know, we need to get Bush out of office. Nobody disagrees about that, but they're also not doing the very, very hard movements to move some of these people to take a really good stand.
Well, the key to I think, Ellen, the key to this is for us to be getting average people who are, like the folks listening to our program, to participate, not just participate by going to the polls, but we've got a bunch of listeners to the show who have actually started infiltrating the Democratic Party. And that, I think, is the key. All these people who sit around going, yeah, there's no place for us. Ralph Nader is our guy, blah-de-blah. I say, why don't you join the Democratic Party? Are you seeing anything there like that? I mean, it almost sounds from the Republican reporting, the right-wing reporting of the average delegate, that a lot of Greens and, quote, lefties have infiltrated the ranks of the delegates.
Well, I think that is hopefully true. I also think it was interesting last night, a woman was taken out screaming from the convention. I mean, you would have thought that it was, I've never seen so many security people go after her. So if you're not, you know, I'm sure you've been to these conventions, you know how they work. They send out every 15 minutes, it's a different sign, and they have captains that are supposed to get everybody to put up the signs. They give you a hand when the signs are to go up, when the signs are to go down.
Right.
Anybody who's out of the picture, man, you're out of there.
Yeah, it's as heavily choreographed as the cheerleading was when George W. Bush was a cheerleader at Andover Prep School. Last question for you here, Ellen. I know you got to boogie on along, but what do you think is going to be the biggest story of today coming out of the convention?
Well, today is Foreign Policy Day here, so they are coming out with two things: stem cell research and foreign policy, and that is really where the focus is today.
At foreign policy being Iraq primarily, or
foreign policy Iraq, how we have not. You know, we're not respected in the world, how Bush has messed up foreign policy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
North Korea?
Actually, I had a conversation with Madeleine Albright, which you can find on the web and hopefully want to use on the show, where she really says to me yesterday that she thinks that North Korea is the biggest problem we have.
Oh, yeah. They've started building nukes, and George just sits around ignoring
them. Exactly, and that's what Madeleine Albright said. I mean, you know, Madeleine Albright was not the most shining person we've ever had in the State Department, but she's no dummy either, and I will tell you, I trust what she says on the nuke issue.
Yeah. Well, and
also, the other thing is, I talked to John Conyers this morning now.
Mm-hmm.
I have a kissy-kissy relationship with Mr. Conyers, and he is, like, beyond out of his mind about the Sudan.
Yeah, I was talking about that this morning, and this report that just came out in England from a think tank that Tony Blair is a patron of, which means he helps fund it, saying that the war in Iraq is the reason why America and England don't have the resources or the ability or the willingness to do anything about the Sudan.
Right.
We can't put some boots on the ground. Anyhow, Ellen, thanks so much for being with us. Ellen Ratner, the Talk Radio News Service, the Bureau Chief in Washington, D.C., and there in Boston today at the Democratic National Convention.
Thanks.
Thanks, Ellen. Have a great one. Take care. It's 19 minutes before the hour. I want to get into, speaking of the convention, Ted Kennedy. And he raised an iconic, an archetypal notion. And here's the statement. And this is really far more significant, I think, than most people realized when he said it.
If each of us cared about the public interest,
if each of us cared about the public interest,
we wouldn't have had the excesses of Enron. We wouldn't have had the abuses of Halliburton. And Vice President Cheney would be retired to an undisclosed location.
Now, he's personally offended by this, and in order to understand Ted Kennedy's being offended by wealthy people exploiting positions in government to gain more wealth, you have to understand his upbringing. There's this notion in European royalty, historically, of noblesse oblige, the idea that if you are wealthy, or if you are a ruler, you have an obligation. It literally means the obligation of nobility. You have an obligation to give back, to be a good steward. It really goes back to when we lived in tribal communities. I mean, it goes back to the pre, you know, the Anglo-Saxon era of England, to pre-Norman conquest. The idea that the tribal chief or the tribal king was really the person who had the greatest obligation, the greatest responsibility, the greatest burden, not the greatest opportunity to steal and get rich. I mean, here we have, you know, tax cuts for the rich. Dick Cheney gets a $300,000 tax cut. The average, typical American gets, forget the word average, the middle class Americans averaged about $100. There's that word again. But if you average it all out, you know, Dick Cheney's tax cuts, Bill Gates' tax cuts, it looks like the average is $1,000. It's not. And so here's Jack Kennedy, his brother, his older brother, talking. This is a set of values that all of the Kennedy brothers were absolutely raised with as a result of Joe and Rose Kennedy. And, yeah, I know Joe could be a nasty guy. I was good friends with Gloria Swanson, the actress who was badly taken advantage of by Joe Kennedy. She used to tell me stories that would curl your hair about Joe Kennedy. But he got it that at least he wanted his children to be raised with the idea of service. Jack Kennedy.
For what Pericles said of the Athenians has long been true of this commonwealth.
Now, by the way, this is a speech that Jack Kennedy gave to the citizens of Massachusetts in the Massachusetts State House as he was leaving to become president of the United States in late 1961, after he had won the presidency. And this is the speech that Ronald Reagan plagiarized.
We do not imitate, for we are a model to others. I have been guided by the standard John Winthrop set before his shipmates on the flagship Arabella 331 years ago.
The Arabella, by the way, a ship that came to Massachusetts.
As they, too, faced the task of building a new government on a perilous frontier, we must always consider, he said, that we shall be as a city upon a hill. The eyes of all people are upon us. Today, the eyes of all people are truly upon us. And our governments, in every branch, at every level, national, state, and local, must be as a city upon a hill, constructed and inhabited by men aware of their great trust and their grave responsibilities.
Now, this was something that Jack Kennedy really and truly believed, as did his brother Robert, as did his brother does his brother Theodore, his brother Ted. They really and truly believe this. Jack Kennedy continues talking about this
issue.
For
those to whom much is given, much is required. And when at some future date the high court of history sits in judgment on each one of us, recording whether in our brief span of service we fulfilled our responsibilities to the state, our success or failure in whatever office we may hold.
Isn't it interesting, let me just pause him for a moment, where he said our obligations to the state. This true belief that the state is us. It's not a them, like the conservatives would, you know, in the conservative world, the state is an it to be destroyed, right? Grover Norquist, we want to shrink government down to the size where we can drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub. But in the American tradition, the ideals of Washington and Jefferson and Adams, the state is we the people. We the people. This is us. We own this government. We own this nation. It's an us.
We'll be measured by the answers to four questions. First.
And here come the four questions. And as he's saying these, think about Dick Cheney making his millions by selling his Halliburton stock at 55, 56, and then it plunges to 18. George Bush's insider deals. All the crony capitalism that is going on inside the Bush administration. It is absolutely obscene. And here's the idealistic and really ran the government by this flip side of that, the possibility.
Were we truly men of courage?
First question, were we truly men of courage? And beyond just, you know, did you show up for your service in Vietnam?
With the courage to stand up to one's enemies and the courage to stand up when necessary to one's own associates. The courage to resist public pressure as well as private greed.
Oh.
Secondly, were we truly men of judgment with perceptive judgment of the future as well as of the past, of our own mistakes as well as the mistakes of others, with enough wisdom to know what we did not know and enough candor to admit it.
And Kennedy would admit his mistakes. And, of course, we know, you know, how George W. handles that sort of thing.
Third, were we truly men of integrity, men who never ran out on either the principles in which they believed or the people who believed in them, men whom neither financial gain nor political ambition could ever divert from the fulfillment of our sacred trust. Finally, were we truly men of dedication? With an honor mortgaged to no single individual or group and compromised by no private obligation or aim, but devoted solely to serving the public good.
And this was the bottom line for Jack Kennedy, and that's why Teddy... It has been all his life for Teddy as well, why he was so furious last night. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number, Jay in Carbondale, Illinois, is on the line. Hey, Jay, what's up? Jay? No Jay there, so we'll move along. Anyway, back to Jack Kennedy for another minute or so.
Here. And the national interest. Courage, judgment, integrity, dedication. These are the historic qualities of the Bay Colony and of the Bay State. The qualities which this state have consistently sent to this chamber.
In the form of John Adams, John Kennedy, and now John Kerry.
Here in Beacon Hill in Boston, and at Capitol Hill back in Washington. And these are the qualities which, with God's help, this son of Massachusetts hopes will characterize our government's conduct in the four stormy years that lie ahead.
Well said. JFK from Massachusetts, as another JFK from Massachusetts, tomorrow night will be speaking before the Democratic National Convention in Boston. 10 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman radio program helping you win the water cooler wars with uncommon sense from the radical middle.
How can there be hope when millions starve in a world of plenty? How can there be justice when the rich parade their wealth before the poor? How can there be peace when each man is his neighbor's enemy? In a world of chaos, peace is possible, but only if we address the root causes of our global crisis, poverty, hunger, and despair. We must share the world's resources to create justice. Without justice, there can be no peace. Fortunately, we're not alone in our efforts. According to futurist Benjamin Krem, a group of enlightened teachers led by Maitreya, the world teacher, is here to inspire a new approach based on the principle of sharing. With their guidance, we can transform the world and create a peaceful future for all. For a free audio CD of an extraordinary lecture by Benjamin Krem on the emergence of the teachers, call toll-free 888-242-8272. Again, that's 888-242-8272.
Are George Bush's policies getting you down? Have you had enough of Bush's messianic militarism? Does John Ashcroft's assault on the Bill of Rights scare you? Do you believe that Dick Cheney had his conscience surgically removed 3 decades ago? Are you angry at the Iraq fiasco that was the brainchild of Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Out of His Wolfowitz? Well, then subscribe to the Progressive Magazine. You'll get the insights of Barbara Ehrenreich, the inspiration of Howard Zinn, and the mirth of Molly Ivins, Will Durst, and Kate Clinton. They'll help you survive this dark age. And check this out. You can subscribe today for only $12 for 12 monthly issues. Simply get on the web and go to www.progressive.org or call 1-800-827-0555 and mention offer radio. That's 1-800-827-0555 and mention the radio offer from the Tom Hartman program. That's the Progressive. It's your antidote to reactionary policies.
Tom Hartman will be speaking out in Santa Fe, New Mexico with We the People, a call to take back America, a Friday evening talk August 27th at the Santa Fe Armory for the Arts, to be followed by a Saturday, August 28th workshop called Waking Up to Personal and Global Transformation. Tom Hartman brings his wit, wisdom, and intelligence to Santa Fe the weekend of August 27th and 28th. Tom Hartman will discuss with us how America faces its greatest threat since a civil war. And Tom Hartman will look at how Western thinking, legends, and myths have caused global problems and endangered democracy and what we can do about it. To get your tickets and more information, call 505-988-2223 in Santa Fe. That's 505-988-2223 or visit greatmystery.org. Tickets for Tom Hartman are also available at Collected Works Bookstore in Santa Fe.
With the workers Rutgers Independent News Service, I'm Sarah Turner, bringing you today's feature story. 49 New Jersey environmental groups in the Save New Jersey Coalition are urging Governor James McGreevy to veto the so-called Fast Track Development Bill. The bill would grant developers fast approvals on building permits. Rebecca Miles reports.
The coalition claims the bill is unconstitutional as it radically changes the permitting system in New Jersey, and many see it as railroading 30 years of environmental protection. I asked Jeff Tittle, director of New Jersey's Sierra Club, what the bill would do if passed.
It allows developers and polluters to be able to have fast-track approval for permitting from DEP and other agencies, including transportation. And what it really means is that in that 45-day clock, the public has no right to comment on permits that may affect their lives and their property and their public and their health.
What many are angry about is that this comes after a long battle to get Governor McGreevy to preserve the highland area around New Jersey's state reservoirs. I asked Thomas Borden from the Rutgers Environmental Law Clinic what he saw as a typical example of how this bill would infringe people's constitutional rights.
There's many areas in New Jersey where development or redevelopment has not occurred because the area is contaminated and is under the jurisdiction of DEP to remediate that site.
What the coalition uncovered in the bill were 12 counts of violation against constitutional rights, to include threats to public health, safety, and public property. They have brought this to the attention of Governor McGreevy. The governor has 45 days to veto or pass the bill, and cannot pass a bill that is considered unconstitutional. For the Workers' Independent News Service, I'm Rebecca Miles in New York.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Welcome back. Mike in our chat room makes the it's a great point. He says the conservative agenda is a bigger threat to personal property in the long run. And I think it's sad that people assume that everyone's attitudes are based on property instead of principles. And I think that that's one of the things we're really seeing here is at the Democratic National Convention is this idea of principles being a guiding beacon, being the thing that, you know, really holds everything together. Here's one last Teddy Kennedy comment. This said the day after, or perhaps 2 days after, Newt Gingrich meets with a group of Republicans and says that we have to campaign on wedge issues. We have to divide people. And he suggested Republicans pick issues such as school prayer, strengthening work requirements for welfare recipients, and barring the United Nations from monitoring U.S. elections, which all polled at higher than an 80% rating. And Deborah Price, chairwoman of the House GOP, says, you know, yeah, this is great. Phil English, a Republican from northwestern Pennsylvania, says, we have a really good wedge issue. And here's Kennedy's thoughts on this.
Our Constitution binds us together. Yet in our own time, there are those who seek to divide us. One community against another. Urban against rural. City against
suburban. This is where he blows his line, but he gets
whites
it back.
Whites against blacks. Men against women. Straits against gays, Americans against Americans. In these challenging times for our country, in these fateful times for the world, America needs a genuine uniter, not a divider who only claims to be a uniter.
And then just laying it out, what does it mean to be a united America, he says.
We believe we are one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. And when we say all, we mean all.
Well said. Ted Kennedy at the Democratic National Convention last night. A man of integrity. Yeah, his private life was rather screwed up in his younger years. That happens to some people. George W. getting arrested for cocaine when he was young, alcoholism, drunk driving. I mean, you know, it happens. We can forgive personal failings, I think. Sometimes we must. But a man who actually builds coalitions with conservatives, with Republicans, one of the very best at it. It's the Tom Hartman Program, the pill that will help you escape the matrix.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
The Founding Fathers thought they'd stop corporations from ever overthrowing elected government. Little did they know that 200 years later, democracy would be stolen and twisted in the name of so-called conservative values. Hi, this is Tom Hartman. The Founders of America fought the Revolutionary War against the excessive corporate power of the East India Company, and presidents from Jefferson to Eisenhower warned us that extremely big businesses could destroy democracy. You'll find this extraordinary American story in my book, Unequal Protection: The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights. It starts with the Boston Tea Party and ends with the rampant corruption of the Bush administration. It tells the dramatic story of how corporations hijacked the Bill of Rights, setting the stage for the CEO takeover of America. And it shows how we can take America back and tells the stories of Americans from Pennsylvania to California who are doing just that right now.
Unequal Protection is available in bookstores nationwide. And you can read several chapters online at unequalprotection.com. That's Unequal Protection by Tom Hart.
Pop and not so pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
A system that will grant legal status to temporary workers who are here in the country working, that'll increase the number of men and women on the path to American citizenship.
That was President George W. Bush speaking before a group of Latino voters earlier this month in San Antonio, Texas. He was promoting immigration reforms that would grant undocumented workers guest worker status so they could legally work in the United States. However, last week, White House officials asked Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist not to offer a bill that would do just that. The bill, sponsored by Republican Senator Larry E. Craig of Idaho, would help 500,000 farm workers gain legal residency. The bill died when the Senate adjourned until fall. The bill had the support of 63 senators, including 27 Republicans and 12 committee chairmen. Craig vowed to introduce the bill next session, which will give the president the opportunity to repeat this statement he made in Texas.
This proposal reflects the interest and best values of America, and Congress should pass it into law.
On Tuesday, during the Democratic National Convention, the Campaign for America's Future hosted a panel of speakers, including Michael Moore and Howard Dean. Former Secretary of Labor under Bill Clinton, Robert Reich, standing at a height of 4 feet 10 inches, spoke about how President Bush's tax cut doesn't help America's workers in a lagging economy.
Now, every time you hear them say and use the word average, watch your wallets. The basketball player Shaquille O'Neal and I have an average height of 6'1". It's just like the Bush tax cuts. They said that the average tax cut is $1,000. But Dick Cheney got a tax cut of $300,000. Most Americans are getting under $100 tax cuts.
A strike by the Illinois Secretary of State employees has been authorized if negotiations fall through. The workers, represented by the Service Employees International Union, could walk off the job as soon as August 16th if their demands aren't met. Secretary of State Jesse White has offered an 8% increase over 4 years. But with union members' pension payments at 4% of their salaries, it would actually only amount to a 4% increase stretched out over 4 years.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Feel like you're working yourself to death? You just might be. New research from Finland finds that work-related stress can double a person's risk of heart attack. Researchers at the University of Helsinki found that otherwise healthy workers who reported persistent stress due to heavy work demands and low job security were just as likely to fall victim to heart attacks as heavy smokers who do not exercise.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You put in 30 years at the company. You got good pay, health care. Then they send you a job overseas. And under George Bush, the company actually gets a tax break for doing it. Now, Bush says we're in recovery. Then after a year, you finally land another job, and you wonder, is this what you worked your whole life for? We're not being led. We're being misled.
See George. See George in our national parks. George knows parks are popular. George likes to go to parks and have the media take his picture there. See George run for president. In his 2000 presidential run, George W. dressed up in khakis and held a photo op in a national park where he decried the $5 billion backlog in making essential repairs to America's deteriorating park system. It's shameful, he said, promising to fix our parks. He didn't. 4 years later, the maintenance need is $6 billion. Speaking of deterioration, Bush's National Park Service announced this February that it would allow BNP Petroleum Corporation to drill for natural gas on Padre Island National Seashore. This will put pipelines, heavy equipment, and large trucks on the longest undeveloped beach in America. Just what you want to see when you go to the solace of the seashore, a drilling rig in your face. It will hurt tourism, the ecosystem, wildlife, and local businesses. Also, one oil corporation can plunder a minor gas deposit that amounts to only one day's worth of fuel for America. Then there's Georgia's effort to, quote, improve Eisenhower Public Park in Nassau County, New York. Though it's a mere county park, the White House directed county officials to make an essential addition to Eisenhower Park prior to Bush's visit there in March. He was going for a fundraiser in a restaurant in the park. Then he was going to walk to a building to meet with some families of 9/11 victims, then proceed to a groundbreaking ceremony for a 9/11 memorial to be built in the park. The new addition demanded by Bush's minions? Sidewalks along every step of Bush's trek. Newsday columnist Jimmy Breslin reports that the word came down from on high. The president's feet are not to touch the dirt. This is Jim Hightower saying, thus, concrete and asphalt were poured so George's feet would not touch the ground, as they rarely have any time in his life.
As a small business owner, doing several things all at the same time is just another day at the office. So Sam's Club offers the option of doing two things at once, buying items you need for your business, while at the same time buying items you need for your home. When you shop at Sam's Club, you get the same everyday low cost on items for your home as you do on items for your business. You've got a lot going on. Count on us to help you get it done. Sam's Club. We are in business for small business.
I'm Jim Hightower, and I've approved this message.
Jim Hightower is not running for office, but he is back this campaign season with an important word about the regime of King George W.
Let's stop beating around the bush. These people are nuts.
Let's Stop Beating Around the Bush is Hightower's hilarious new best-selling book, offering you unvarnished facts, insight, and humor to get you through this year's political spin cycle. Buy Let's Stop Beating Around the Bush today and make politics fun again. Available at bookstores everywhere and on the web at jimhightower.com. Buy it today.
Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 7 minutes past the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. For periodic announcements on our guests' topics about the show and news of what's going on, sign up for our newsletter, www.tomhartman.com. We do not share or sell the list. T-H-O-M, Hartman with two N's, is the official website, but pretty much however you spell it, you'll get there. Earlier this year, the White House released documents that it said proved George Bush fulfilled his National Guard service during the Vietnam War. In fact, they did not prove it at all. Scotty, beam me up, Scotty, said the documents means he served, and that there's no longer any question about the president, whether the president actually showed up to fulfill his duty. But according to new records released late last week, I'm surprised the Democrats aren't talking about this more, Bush did not accumulate any flying hours at all for several months during 1972. According to Bloomberg News Service, newly released computerized records provide no record of Bush's whereabouts between July 72 and September 72, when he was supposed to be serving in the Alabama National Guard. Earlier this month, the Pentagon said those documents had been inadvertently destroyed, but apparently there's computer records. The AP press is suing for the ones that the Texas State Archives have. However, President Bush has refused to authorize their release, forcing the Associated Press to invoke the Freedom of Information Act. They're hoping they can stall this thing until after the elections. Republicans running scared. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, if you'd like to call in. And in fact, Phil in Tampa, Florida is on the line. Hey, Phil, what's up?
Hi. I am one of the people that I get a monthly email from Zogby and asked questions on the presidential race.
So you're one of the pollees. When they do a Zogby poll, you're one of the guys they're questioning.
Right. Except a couple of weeks ago I got one and got some very, very interesting questions at the end. I don't know if you're aware of it or not, but Howard Stern, who has a national show, is very much in favor of Kerry, hates Bush.
Yeah, he's, in fact, the week that Howard Stern flipped from Bush to Kerry was a week later was when he got pulled off the air on some stations, and a few weeks after that, the FCC decided to start prosecuting him for something he did 2 years ago.
Right, but he added stations within the last 2 weeks. He's now in Tampa and a bunch of other places.
Yeah,
but here's the point. In this questionnaire that I got online, it says, do you listen to the Howard Stern show?
Oh, interesting.
And it says, how many times a week do you listen?
So they're trying to figure out if this guy is actually having any influence on the elections.
That's right. I think they're going to try to correlate, perhaps, my answers on who do you prefer in the election to whether or not I listen to Howard Stern.
Now, have they ever asked you whether you listen to Limbaugh or Hannity
or
Al Franken or anybody else?
No. This is the first time they've ever asked me, and this has been going on 6 months.
Yeah.
This is the first time I've ever asked me about who I listen to on the radio.
Huh.
I think it's pretty, I think the statistic that came out that I read on the internet was that Herr Limbaugh is like 92-94% of his listening audience is conservative, and about 3% liberal, and the rest won't tell. But, you know, he's preaching to the choir.
Well, and not only that, Howard Stern has a radio audience that's easily twice, probably three or four times that of Limbaugh's. I mean, he overstates his numbers by using weekly and monthly cumulative averages rather than an instantaneous daily. And I'm sorry, this is inside radio stuff. But in any case, you know, Stern is huge and Limbaugh's is big. So.
Well, yeah, and people tend to listen to Stern all day.
Yeah.
Because of the fact that, you know, he has different guests on and everything else, when the only guest on the Limbaugh show is Rush Limbaugh.
Right.
You know, he's the only horse in the race, and of course he wins the race every time because he's the only horse in the race.
What a surprise. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's very telling. And I can't remember the gal's name, but she ran for governor of New Jersey, and then she was EPA administrator under Bush.
Christy Todd Whitman. Christy Todd Whitman.
Yeah, he really promoted her on the radio show, and she won, and she has always said that if it weren't for Howard Stern's listeners, she wouldn't have made it over the top.
Yeah, she's on record on that. Phil, thanks for the information. That's a fascinating story. Keep us apprised as the Zogby questions come down, particularly if any of them are a little strange. I'd love to find out, you know, what's going on with it. Thanks.
All right,
thanks for the tip. 12 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Our number 1-866-889-8894. Rick in Grand Rapids, Michigan's on the line. Hey, Rick, what's up?
Day to you, Tom. I was wanting to comment on the speech by Ron Reagan last night, but
sure.
But more to the point, I don't know if you got a chance to see Michael Reagan comment on his brother's speech.
No, I didn't.
Well, it was almost kind of a childish response. It came down to the point of, what did you think of it, you know? And it was basically that, well, my brother is trading on our dad's name, you know, and I'm thinking of the fact that Michael Reagan himself
has built an entire career on his dad's name.
And he was adopted.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm not going to knock him because he was adopted.
No,
but
I mean, it's more appropriate to say that at least Ron Reagan, that was his birth name, you know?
Yeah, well, they both legally have the name, but for Michael Reagan to accuse his brother of trading on his father's name, first of all, Ron Reagan, I would be amazed if he was paid to give that speech at the DNC. I mean, that,
he was working
just
for MSNBC after he got done making it.
Yeah, so he gives a speech for something that he believes in and cares about because it might have saved his dad's life if it had been done early enough, and his brother, who has made a fortune trading on his father's name, the same father, this is bizarre.
It gets
Cain and Abel.
Because then they ask how Nancy was with it.
Yeah.
Well, Nancy, as you know, is not going to speak at the Republican convention, and I think she pretty much gave either tacit or actual approval. But here was how Michael Reagan responded. It was almost like the Smothers Brothers. He says, well, you know, as far as Nancy is concerned, Ron can do no wrong. And so it's like, you know, she always liked Ron best. So, you know, just a completely childish response from a man who I'm assuming is in his 50s, you know. And
yeah.
I don't know what it is, you know, about these conservatives, but they just seem to be angry all the time for no reason.
Well, there's some very interesting psychological studies that have been done about conservatives, and the whole idea that it's really there's a fear-driven psychology there. There's an inadequacy-driven psychology.
Yes.
People who are unable to accept others as they are, you know, it's, oh, he's gay. Oh, keep him away. Or you know, it's a different religion. Oh, you know, they're not going to go to heaven with us. You know, and people who are into this kind of stuff, or, you know, it's not my job to worry about whether or not some child is in poverty. You know, people who just, are into this total me, mine, you know, keep them away, they, them. It's a mental illness.
Or even like Trent Lott and George Bush in college being cheerleaders instead of going into ROTC and then never really serving, but being very anxious to send other young men and women off to war.
Yeah, yeah, it's a tragedy. It's a tragedy. Rick, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
I appreciate a good note. Interesting little factoid, and life moves along, right? There's just so much going on right now. One of the big things that's going on right now is, and this is the thing to keep your eyes out for, is this whole voting machine thing. I wrote an article about this 2 years ago, I think it was. It was published on commondreams.org and syndicated all across the Internet, and then MoveOn.org asked me to write a piece that they were going to email out to 1.7 million people about, I don't know, 6-8 months ago, something like that, and which I did, and it was also published on Alternet. And you can find both of those at tomhartmann.com. Just click on the little link that says Articles on Democracy, and you'll find all these pieces that I've written. And it was the first, it was one of the first kind of mainstream publication out there beyond just the conspiracy sites, as it were, piece to talk about, is it possible not only that electronic voting machines might lead to voting fraud, but that they might have already led to voting fraud, that the 2002 election was a testing ground for this, and that it even goes back beyond that. In the article, the first article, the first op-ed piece I wrote about this, well, it was an article really. It was kind of a news report. It starts out with maybe these various politicians, Saxby Chambliss was actually elected over Max Cleland, but you may not know it because there's no paper trail, right? I mean, you know, could it be that the polls in Georgia were that weird that they just one day, I mean, you know, a couple days before the election, Max Cleland, the decorated war hero who left three limbs, his right arm and both his legs, on the battlefield in Vietnam, Max Cleland, who Georgia loved. I mean, I used to live in Atlanta. This guy was my senator. And Georgia loved Max Cleland, and this guy, this Democrat, had a Republican, Saxby Chambliss, run against him who got out of going to Vietnam because he had a bad knee, or at least that's what he told his draft board. His knee's good enough now that he can, you know, run up in front of a camera whenever CNN flips one on, but he had a bad knee back during Vietnam, and so he was a draft dodger, this guy. Now, first of all, let me say I have no problem with draft dodgers from the Vietnam era. But, or and, if somebody wants to dodge the draft and then later put themselves in a position where they are making moral pronouncements about how important it is that they send other people's children off to die in a war of dubious justification, then I start to have a problem with it. So anyhow, this guy runs these ads attacking Max Cleland, morphing Max Cleland's face into that of Osama bin Laden in the 2002 election, just a few months after 9/11, starts running these ads. And even at that, this draft dodger, Saxby Chambliss, could not get above Max Cleland in the polls. The polls all clearly showed that Max Cleland was going to win, as well as the Democratic governor of Georgia, that he was going to win. And oddly enough, when Georgians went to the polls, residents of Georgia went to the polls, they discovered that there were no paper ballots, there was no paper trail, they got no receipt, there was nothing, except touchscreen machines, by and large, most of them from Diebold. And oddly enough, oh, and a bunch of cards from Atlanta, primarily African-American districts of Atlanta, vanished and then showed up later to be counted, memory cards that held the votes. And one of our a fellow who was a producer of this program last year, Joe, he actually went in, tried to enter a write-in candidate, and he crashed six voting machines in Cobb County, Georgia. Six of them. And each one, when it crashed, lost all its votes in a Democratic district, in an area, you know. And then these guys win by the same margins that showed that they were losing. Well, anyhow, Ohio now, the ACLU is suing in Ohio. Stuff happening in California. Stuff happening all over the country, actually. Let me share that with you real quickly after this break. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 20 minutes past the hour, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates lock out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
I'm sorry, there's nothing more we can do. No one wants to hear those devastating words from a doctor. But that's what millions of Americans suffering from diseases like Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and diabetes will be told if you vote for Ralph Nader. Americans who voted for Nader put Bush in the White House in 2000. As president, George W. put the brakes on embryonic stem cell research, which could lead to revolutionary new treatments and cures. John Kerry vows to push this research forward. George W. Bush is still taking orders from the religious right. He wants to stifle stem cell research. This time, don't help him. Don't vote for Ralph. The Committee for the Advancement of Stem Cell Research approved this message. It was not approved by any candidate, nor any candidate's committee. Visit CASCR.org.
For more than 27 years, the Progressive magazine In These Times has provided groundbreaking coverage of movements for social, environmental, and economic justice. Author and broadcast personality Studs Terkel calls In These Times his bi-weekly tonic. In These Times features award-winning reporting and analysis of national and international news. Find In These Times on your newsstand or visit us online at www.inthesetimes.com or call 1-800-827-0270. 1-800-827-0270.
Do the Republicans or the Democrats have a clear vision for America that actually includes democracy, fairness, and justice? Do the Greens or the Progressives? How can we create a shared vision of the kind of future we want for our children? This is Tom Hartman, and I'll be exploring these and many other issues with guests from a wide variety of viewpoints, as well as taking your calls.
The Tom Hartman Show, 12 p.m. till 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Are George Bush's policies getting you down? Have you had enough of Bush's messianic militarism? Does John Ashcroft's assault on the Bill of Rights scare you? Do you believe that Dick Cheney had his conscience surgically removed 3 decades ago? Are you angry at the Iraq fiasco that was the brainchild of Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul out of his Wolfowitz? Well, then subscribe to the Progressive Magazine. You'll get the insights of Barbara Ehrenreich, the inspiration of Howard Zinn, and the mirth of Molly Ivins, Will Durst, and Kate Clinton. They'll help you survive this dark age. And check this out. You can subscribe today for only $12 for 12 monthly issues. Simply get on the web and go to www.progressive.org or call 1-800-827-0555 and mention offer radio. That's 1-800-827-0555 and mention the radio offer from the Tom Hartman Program. That's the Progressive. It's your antidote to reactionary policies.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, I left Kentucky back in 49 and went to Detroit working on assembly line.
Welcome back. The first year
they had me putting wheels on Cadillacs.
Good old Johnny Cash.
Every day I'd watch them beauties roll by and sometimes I'd hang my head and cry. Cause I always wanted me one that was long and black. One day I devised myself a plan that should be the envy of most any man.
I'll let you get the song and listen to the rest of the story. Johnny Cash there. Welcome back, friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 25 minutes past the hour. What is going on in Florida? What is going on in Florida? In Jacksonville, Florida, there was a bunch of aliens, not space aliens, no. People from other countries, born in other countries, who became citizens of the United States. And, you know, they went in and they'd taken their tests. They'd gone through this multi-year process. They'd been through the right part. They did everything exactly the way you're supposed to do it because they believed in the idea that America is the land of freedom. You can vote for anybody you want. And they raised their right hand and they swore an oath to the Constitution of the United States. And they walked out of the room, and there was a table where you could sign, you could register to vote. It said, voter registration here. Register to vote here. And this, you know, on public property. And they thought, hey, this is cool. We should, you know, I should register to vote. I just became a citizen. It's the highest obligation. And a Republican American citizen, by the name of Linda Cross, went there with her husband, Dario Cruz, who was becoming naturalized, who got his American citizenship. She was Republican. He was a Democrat. But they got married anyway. He takes his oath. They walk out. He picks up a sheet to register. And she, being a Republican, looks at, but one of good faith, shall we say, looks at it and says, this is odd. What party do you want to name as your party affiliation is pre-checked as Republican, which means that he could only vote in Florida in the Republican primaries. He couldn't vote in the Democratic primaries. It would be against the law or as an independent. And so she goes over and she says to the people at the table, do you have one of these things that doesn't say Republican? Because my husband here, who just became a citizen, he's a Democrat. And they said, no, sorry, they're all pre-marked Republican. This is a third-degree felony in the state of Georgia. A felony. to alter voter registration forms without the voter's consent. And these were pre-altered. Nobody had consented. How does Jeb Bush respond to this? How does the Republican Party of Florida respond to this? Well, first, Joseph Agostini, a spokesman for the Republican Party of Florida, said they had nothing to do with this particular little activity. Turns out, the Florida Times Union identified one of those registering voters as being a Republican volunteer named Millie McLean. McLean was identified last October as being in charge of voter registration drives to the Republican Women's Club of Duval County Federated, one of dozens of clubs statewide that are chartered by, guess who, the Republican Party of Florida. She, of course, now refuses to answer questions from the newspaper about this third-degree felony that she committed. But the state has decided it's not a big deal. It's not a big deal. They're not going to prosecute. She's learned her lesson. It's you know, nothing to worry about. Just let it go. Carlberg, this Dick Carlberg, the assistant supervisor of elections for Duval County, he says, at worst, it was unethical. It depends on your point of view. Yeah, unethical, at the worst. Messing with your vote. Making it illegal for you to vote in a Democratic primary. Well, that ain't nothing compared to what happened to the records of who voted against Jeb Bush in Florida in 2002. I'll tell you about that right after this.
At last, there's a positive focus on a condition that affects millions. Read The Edison Gene, ADHD and the Gift of the Hunter Child by Tom Hartman, best-selling author of Attention Deficit Disorder, A Different Perception. John Rady, author of User's Guide to the Brain, says this about The Edison Gene.
Once again, with tireless scholarship and a bit of poetry, Tom Hartman helps take us to the edge of knowing ourselves, our brains, and our world.
The Edison Gene, available in bookstores everywhere.
Pop and not so pop culture, democracy and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
A system that will grant legal status to temporary workers who are here in the country working, that will increase the number of men and women on the path to American citizenship.
That was President George W. Bush speaking before a group of Latino voters earlier this month in San Antonio, Texas. He was promoting immigration reforms that would grant undocumented workers guest worker status so they could legally work in the United States. However, last week, White House officials asked Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist not to offer a bill that would do just that. The bill, sponsored by Republican Senator Larry E. Craig of Idaho, would help 500,000 farm workers gain legal residency. The bill died when the Senate adjourned until fall. The bill had the support of 63 senators, including 27 Republicans and 12 committee chairmen. Craig vowed to introduce the bill next session, which will give the president the opportunity to repeat this statement he made in Texas.
This proposal reflects the interest and best values of America, and Congress should pass it into law.
On Tuesday, during the Democratic National Convention, the Campaign for America's Future hosted a panel of speakers, including Michael Moore and Howard Dean. Former Secretary of Labor under Bill Clinton, Robert Reich, standing at a height of 4 feet 10 inches, spoke about how President Bush's tax cut doesn't help America's workers in a lagging economy.
Now, every time you hear them say and use the word average, watch your wallets. The basketball player Shaquille O'Neal and I have an average height of 6'1". It's just like the Bush tax cuts. They said that the average tax cut is $1,000. But Dick Cheney got a tax cut of $300,000. Most Americans are getting under $100 tax cuts.
A strike by the Illinois Secretary of State employees has been authorized if negotiations fall through. The workers, represented by the Service Employees International Union, could walk off the job as soon as August 16th if their demands aren't met. Secretary of State Jesse White has offered an 8% increase over 4 years. But with union members' pension payments at 4% of their salaries, it would actually only amount to a 4% increase stretched out over 4 years.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Feel like you're working yourself to death? You just might be. New research from Finland finds that work-related stress can double a person's risk of heart attack. Researchers at the University of Helsinki found that otherwise healthy workers who reported persistent stress due to heavy work demands and low job security were just as likely to fall victim to heart attacks as heavy smokers who do not exercise.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Here they come again, catch us if you can, time to get a move on, we were young with all of our might, catch us if you can.
Well, that's the theme song for Jeb Bush and the Republicans in Florida. Catch us if you can, and they're pretty sure you can't. You know, in the 2002 election, Jeb was up for re-election, and strange things happened. Very strange things happened. There were numerous reports out of Florida of people who showed up, and there were these electronic voting machines that had no receipt and no paper trail. And people would go in and they would push the name of Jeb's opponent. I forget the name of the guy who ran against him for governor of Florida. That memorable, huh? But actually, you know, the opponent was within spitting distance. The polls were showing that it was a very tight race and there was a good chance Jeb would lose. The same thing was true of the, the attorney general or lieutenant governor? Whatever the race was that, Janet Reno was running for. Yeah. And people would push the button for Jeb's opponent, and the screen would flash for a moment saying, thank you for voting for Jeb Bush, and then, you know, move on to the next screen. And people would say, what? They'd go to the voting folks and say, you know, it said, thank you for the vote for Jeb Bush. Well, did you push the Jeb Bush button? No, I pushed the other person. Well, that's what got recorded. Don't worry about it. Well, it turns out that what got recorded was a vote for Jeb Bush, and when somebody didn't go away, but said, "Hey, come on over here and look at this," you know, and called a news reporter, and it got in the news. The machine company came in and said, "Well, we have a misaligned touch screen, misaligned." Right? See, the touch screen itself is, you know, there's like little cutouts. In a, you know, like stencils, you know, those little cutouts in a piece of paper, and you push through them, and whatever's underneath, and so it, you know, it doesn't, the touch screen part doesn't know what the display part is displaying. It's programmed separately. And so they said, you know, apparently this thing was misaligned, so that somehow by accident, if you pushed the button for Bush's opponent, it recorded as a vote for Bush. And it seems that if you pushed the vote for Bush, it also recorded as a vote for Bush. And the same kind of thing seemed to have been happening in the race between Janet Reno and Bill McBride. So a group called the Miami-Dade Election Reform Commission, a citizens group, sued the state and they said, we would like to see the actual electronic records. Because there's no paper trail. We'd like to see the electronic records of how many votes were cast, in which voting machines, in which precincts, in which counties, in which, you know, in the state. Who voted for whom? And that lawsuit, where they actually said to the state, okay, you've got to provide us with this information, that lawsuit led to this news story in today's Salon.com. Dateline, July 28th, 2004, today. I kid you not, straight stand-up news, Dateline Miami, Associated Press. A computer crash erased detailed records from Miami-Dade County's first widespread use of touchscreen voting machines, raising again the specter of elections troubles in Florida, where the new technology was supposed to put an end to such problems. The crashes occurred in May and November of 2003, that being 6 and 12 months after the election, erasing information from the September 2002 gubernatorial primaries and other elections, officials said today. Said Tuesday. The malfunction was made public after the Miami-Dade Election Reform Coalition, a citizens group, requested all data from the 2002 gubernatorial primary between candidates, Democratic candidates Janet Reno and Bill McBride. They go on to add, last month, state officials said the touchscreen system used by 11 counties had a bug in it that would make a manual recount impossible. State election officers say manual recounts are not needed. You get that? They say to Jeb Bush, hey, your machines aren't working, and somehow you're losing all the records, so we can't even see to the extent to which they didn't work. And Bush's office, and the state election officers, and of course these are, you know, the Catherine Harris, right? She was the head of the George Bush reelection committee, the head of the Jeb Bush for election committee, and the Secretary of State who was supervising the purging of tens of thousands of African Americans off the voter rolls in the year 2000, even though they had committed no crime whatsoever. What do they have to say? Well, to quote the Associated Press, state election officials say manual recounts are not needed. The officials also maintain that the computer systems running the machines, that, by the way, would be Windows from Microsoft, that the computer systems running the machines can be trusted to count the votes accurately as they're cast and give the final numbers when needed. Now, aren't you reassured? I am so happy to know that. I am just, you know, I will sleep well tonight. 1-866-889-8894. Let's hear from somebody in Florida. Armin in Florida. Hey, Armin in Tampa, right?
Sarasota.
There you go. Actually,
hey,
it says that on my screen.
You don't like me to read, but please let me do this. This is so important. It's short, and you'll like it. Trust me.
Okay.
Okay, I call this the Mother J of all skits. John Kerry steps up to the podium at the Democratic convention. The crowd cheers enthusiastically. He immediately picks up a red telephone that he shows the crowd. He then sets the phone down so all can see and dials a number for all to hear. Ring, ring, ring. A lady answers the phone on their other end. Hello? John then asks, Mr. Bush, please. A voice like W's answers the phone. W here. John then says, it's come to my attention that you claim to have already captured the rural heartland vote. W answers in that stuttering voice, yeah, my touch screens, I'm in better touch with their values. John, right. John immediately says, not so fast, Mr. Bush. I think the people in the heartland of America are smarter than you think they are. In the 3 years you've been in office, we've lost over $1.5 million, $40,000 a year good-paying manufacturing jobs. We have 42% higher health insurance premiums, 44% higher prescription cost, and a record $48 billion monthly trade deficit. Do you really believe, Mr. Bush, that's heartland values? Bush stutters.
You got to wrap this thing up.
I will. I'm almost wrapping it up.
Okay.
Bush stutters. Well, Kerry responds, the Democrats were and are champions of Social Security and Medicare. You and the Republicans are against it. The Republicans were against it when Roosevelt and Johnson signed the two into law. Mr. Bush, Kerry, further response, can you imagine all the rural seniors in the heartland of America without Social Security or Medicare, especially in this economy? Is that your heartland values? Bush responds, Kerry then says, what about minimum wage?
Armin, you're killing it. I'm sorry. It's just
all the small farmers.
I'm sorry, Armin. I just, I trusted you. I thought, you know, it would be something short You done me wrong here. So anyhow, and it's not touchscreen machines here. The Hanging Chad, that much maligned product of punch card voting, according to the Associated Press, is on its way to the courtroom in Ohio. Now, this talk about the law of unintended consequences. Here we've got punch card voting machines, And the ACLU has gone in and said, these things screwed up the vote in Florida, hanging chads and whatnot. You can't use them. And therefore, the state says, fine, we'll put in touchscreen machines with no receipt. Well, that's part of it. The other part is they still have the punch card machines, but only or largely in black districts. Yep. It's Greg Palast pointed this out a little while ago. He said, it's amazing. I heard a politician on TV the other day talking about how the votes get spoiled in minority districts. And minority being, in this case, code for African-American. And then he goes into this rant about how, these people can't learn how to use these machines. I'm not sure that that's our problem, blah, blah, blah. Implying that the reason that there was a problem was because people were stupid in African-American communities. And what it turns out is that, and Greg Palast, he did the research on this thing. He lays this thing out, that in the African-American communities in America, they have the machine. And what's really, really weird is that the machinery, the state is providing this stuff. In some cases, it's the counties. Okay, so maybe a county has more money than another. But it's the African-American communities that have the machines that are broken in the first place. They're more likely to misfunction, malfunction, not work at all. The machines are broken in the first place. It's got nothing to do with the voters. Even when it's the punch card machines down in Duval County, Florida, in a largely African-American community, for some reason, in the 2000 election, the George Bush, Al Gore, for some reason that nobody still knows to this day, when you slide those punch cards down into the envelope or into that little slot there and you punch through, for some reason, instead of them seating all the way down at the bottom so that when you punch through, you're actually punching the right punches, they seated about a quarter of an inch high. It was like, what had happened? Nobody's really sure. But the cards didn't seat right. Maybe somebody put a screw in there, or a nail, or a little piece of metal, or dropped some staples down into that slot, somehow sabotaged it, so that when you slid that card in, it didn't go all the way down. So when you pushed through the thing you thought you were voting for, you were actually voting for something else. This has nothing to do with the intellect of voters. The ACLU argues that punch card ballots are more likely to go uncounted because of problems such as being partly punched or hanging chads, reports the Associated Press, than votes with other systems, and that the use of ballots violates the voting rights of blacks who mostly live in the punch card counties, this being in Ohio. They claim that the lawsuit violates the 14th Amendment, which guarantees equal protection under the law. So, in response, and the ACLU, by the way, has filed suits like this in Florida, Georgia, Illinois, Maryland, and California. Ohio says, cool, we will replace these punch card machines with touchscreen machines that have no receipt. What a wonderful solution. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, Jonathan in Palm Desert. That Palm Desert, California, Jonathan?
Yep, that's correct.
Hey, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you. I just saw this article online. I actually saw it a couple of days ago, and it seems to be making the rounds. The Federal Reserve Bank has put out a study saying that believing in hell has economic benefits.
Say what?
A study that countries that believe in hell have, quote, lower corruption and a higher standard of living.
Now, as opposed to countries, I would say probably the country that most rigorously and thoroughly believes in hell, of all the countries on earth, is Saudi Arabia. They have every Friday afternoon in the soccer stadium, they have public beheadings of people who are caught in the act of adultery. They have publicly cut the hands and feet off of people who are pickpockets and things. And they do this, they say, The maiming of people is done because the Quran says that it's better to be wounded. Well, it's a variation on the biblical thing where Jesus said, better to pluck your eye out than burn in hell, right? And right. There's similar language in the Quran. And so they say that they are preventing people from going to hell by doing this, that there's a religious basis for this, and that you know, if somebody has committed a crime, that if they execute them in public, that that's actually a form of ablution, that they are, you know, some way diminished of their crime, they're less likely to go to hell. I'd say the most hell-fearing society in the world is Saudi Arabia. And you're trying to tell me that they have the lowest level of corruption?
Well, that's what the St. Louis Fed is trying to tell us. I just think this is one more way that they're trying to sneak organized religion directly into, or like, break down the separation of church and state, and almost the separation between church and economics.
That
as well.
Is so bizarre, Jonathan. You know, what's interesting is the St. Louis Fed also published last week, and maybe it was part of the whole same report. I didn't read the whole thing, but I got a piece of this. Published the report that I quoted here on the air either yesterday or the day before about how in the last 3 years the percentage of workers' income as a percentage of gross domestic product has dropped by 3.6%, while corporate profits as a percentage of GDP have gone up 4 points, 4%. And I'm not talking about 4% drop in income. 3.6% of GDP, you know, worker pay has been reduced by 3.6% of GDP, 3.6% of the total gross domestic product, and 4% of the gross domestic product has increased. Corporate profits have increased to the extent that they now represent an additional 4% of gross domestic product. And so maybe they, you know, tossed that thing in about, you know, countries that believe in hell have less corruption as a way of saying, you know, don't look at that man behind the curtain, being the statistics that they just released. Because, you know, if it's not corporate and governmental corruption that leads to this kind of stuff, these kind of statistics, you know, the wiping out of the middle class, what else is it?
Yeah, well, this is a report I saw on CNN. It's a Reuters report.
Yeah, amazing. Well, it's not surprising that CNN or Reuters would be reporting on that and not listed the actual numbers that I just shared with you, which also on that web on the Fed's website there in St. Louis last week. Thanks, Jonathan, for the call. Great to hear from you.
Yeah, no problem.
10 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Straight to the heart of truth. The Tom Hartman Radio Program. Stick around. We'll be right back.
How can there be hope when millions starve in a world of plenty? How can there be justice when the rich parade their wealth before the poor? How can there be peace when each man is his neighbor's enemy? In a world of chaos, peace is possible, but only if we address the root causes of our global crisis, poverty, hunger, and despair. We must share the world's resources to create justice. Without justice, there can be no peace. Fortunately, we're not alone in our efforts. According to futurist Benjamin Krem, a group of enlightened teachers led by Maitreya, the world teacher, is here to inspire a new approach based on the principle of sharing. With their guidance, we can transform the world and create a peaceful future for all. For a free audio CD of an extraordinary lecture by Benjamin Krem on the emergence of the teachers, call toll-free 888-242-8272. Again, that's 888-242-8272.
The Founding Fathers thought they'd stop corporations from ever overthrowing elected government. Little did they know that 200 years later, democracy would be stolen and twisted in the name of so-called conservative values. Hi, this is Tom Hartman. The Founders of America fought the Revolutionary War against the excessive corporate power of the East India Company, and presidents from Jefferson to Eisenhower warned us that extremely big businesses could destroy democracy. You'll find this extraordinary American story in my book, Unequal Protection: The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights. It starts with the Boston Tea Party and ends with the rampant corruption of the Bush administration. It tells the dramatic story of how corporations hijacked the Bill of Rights, setting the stage for the CEO takeover of America. And it shows how we can take America back and tells the stories of Americans from Pennsylvania to California who are doing just that right now.
Unequal Protection is available in bookstores nationwide. And you can read several chapters online at unequalprotection.com. That's Unequal Protection by Tom Hartman.
Are you or a loved one making too many trips to the bathroom? Listen closely because you're not alone. Over 30 million men suffer from an enlarged prostate. That's why if you make frequent trips to the bathroom, have urgency, hesitancy, or a diminished sex drive, then Super Prostate Formula is for you. It was designed by nationally recognized physician Dr. Michael Toplitsky. The results with his patients have been amazing. Reclaim control now and join the thousands of satisfied customers who have had incredible results with Super Prostate Formula. When you order two bottles of Dr. Toplitsky's Super Prostate Formula, you'll also get two bottles of his Super Libido Formula, an all-natural alternative to Viagra to enhance sexual vitality and performance, plus his book, Complete Guide to Prostate Health, and his newsletter, a total $100 value free as your gift. Guaranteed or your money back. If you're not completely satisfied, return it for a full refund and keep his Libido Formula book and newsletter free as your gift. Not available in stores. Call now, 800-452-0978. 800-452-0978. That's 800-452-0978.
Mega media giant Clear Channel Communications refused to allow an anti-war group to buy space on a billboard in Times Square during the Republican National Convention through Election Day. But public pressure forced Clear Channel to finally accept an ad showing a giant peace dove and a ticker displaying the cost of the war in Iraq in dollars. The 150-foot-long sign will be displayed at Broadway and 42nd Street. WIN correspondent Rebecca Miles reports.
Project Billboard, an anti-war group based in California and interested in encouraging public debate, filed a lawsuit against Clear Channel Communications alleging breach of contract. What is at stake is a billboard advertisement that Project Billboard contracted to run with Clear Channel. The advertisement featured a red, white, blue character of a bomb with the caption, "Democracy is better taught by example, not by war." Clear Channel rejected the first advertisement, saying they were not going to run bomb copy in New York City. Project Billboard then replaced the bomb image with a red and white blue dove, accompanied by the same words, but this was also rejected. They claim that Clear Channel had suggested that the billboard be an image of a little girl waving a flag. Clear Channel Communications is one of the nation's largest media companies with close ties to National Republicans. I asked Deborah Rappaport, founder of the Project Billboard, whether she thought the debate had begun, as Clear Channel Communications' rejection of the billboard had started a flurry of debate in television and newspaper stories.
This was never our intent to get into any sort of a fight like this. We're not unhappy that our message is getting out, but we would be many, many, many times happier if it were getting out in the mode that we had chosen.
We put a call into Clear Channel Communications for comment, but it by news broadcast had no response. For the Workers Independent News Service, I'm Rebecca Miles in...
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Last night, Louise and I had dinner with a friend from Canada, a Canadian, who told us that when she votes, they do it on paper with a pencil, and that she had actually been one of the vote counters in the last election, volunteered. And they count the votes on paper, with paper, after the election, and still, at the end of the day, it only takes about 2 hours to count them all up and add them up and phone them in. And there's a very solid paper trail. But the city of Barrie in Canada actually started with voting machines in 97. They thought they were ahead of the curve. They just decided to dump them. They're going back to paper in Canada. 1-866-889-8894. Cecilia in Winter Park, Florida on the line. Hey, Cecilia, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Weren't you one of the ones that called out the discuss the situation a long time ago, and you were kind of poo-pooed?
You mean about the voting machines?
Yes.
Yeah, when I wrote that first piece in which I outed Chuck Hagel. Chuck Hagel had been the president of ES&S, one of the two big voting machines companies in the United States in Nebraska, which is based in Nebraska. And it's the startup which became the company, which became the company, which became ES&S, was funded by a family, a very wealthy family there, that believes that the Bible should replace the Constitution. And he did not reveal to the voters of Nebraska that he was the president of a voting machine company on whose votes they were being counted. And he just said he was a businessman. He ran for the United States Senate and had this incredible upset victory. This was 8 years ago. And I interviewed the guy that he ran against who claims that he stole the election. But the local newspaper, the main newspaper in Nebraska, is also owned by this family and apparently never really reported the story or didn't do it the way Charlie Matoka thought it should be done, the Democrats. So,
Well, you know, I'll tell you something.
Me and Bev Harris.
It's a situation that is so grave that, if you could believe it, even Drudge had it on his website last night.
Oh, really?
Yes. In big red letters. And yet the Florida officials in Tallahassee are running around, you know, doing this big PR thing, going, don't worry, be happy, everything is fine. And I've got to tell people they have got to take their vote into their own hands. And I'll tell you what, thank you, ACLU. My dues are going for a good cause.
Yeah, there you go. And you know, the flip side, or not the flip side, the other thing is, you know, get active. Get in there and get involved.
I'm an activist. I'm out there all the time.
Wonderful. Cecilia, thanks. Thanks for calling in. Great to hear from you.
My pleasure, Tom.
Yep, do good. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Our program today produced by Louise. Thank you for that. Thank you, Brad, for the music. Thanks, Shelby, for streaming us around the planet. Thanks to our sponsors, the Committee for the Advancement of Stem Cell Research, Benjamin Krim, Small Dog Electronics. Thanks to Mike Toth for our archives, and Ben with White Rose Society. Thanks to the folks in our chat room for showing up. Thanks to Jay for writing and producing our theme music. And thanks to you for listening today. See you tomorrow, same time, same place.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
While the world seems to be collapsing around us, there is hope. Tom Hartman's inspiring book, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, The Fate of the World and What We Can Do Before It's Too Late, has just been re-released. The new updated version is available now and offers solutions to the issues that concern us most: eco-damage, genetic engineering, virulent disease, the end of cheap oil, water shortages, global famine, wars. We can still do something about it and create a world that will work for us and our children's children. As the inspiration